Well, we're going to begin with the fossil record. So there's really no valid supported alternative model that accounts for the structure that we see the fossil record. It was well known in the 18th and 19th centuries that the Earth has gone through multiple epochs where life on the planet took on completely different forms. Also, taxonomists have known for literally centuries how to diagnose a species based on anatomical characteristics in its fossil remains. Taxonomists have also known for centuries how to do this with current living organisms as well. So in the fossil record, just like today, we have there are birds, reptiles, mammals, amphibians, fish, plants, all of that stuff in the fossil record, plus countless other organisms exist, but they're almost exclusively different from the organisms of today, which is an important detail. The fossil record also contains countless organisms that don't really fit into any modern groups, such as early synapsids. That's a good example. So from this, from these observations, there is an
idea develops. And the idea is basically that, well, organisms come about through reproduction. That's where every organism we've ever seen comes from. So therefore, the organisms of the present are the descendants of the organisms of the past. However, since organisms of the past are different from organisms of the present, this suggests that species change over time. This is evolution. There have been many iterations and ideas about how evolution is proposed to have occurred. Charles Darwin is not the first person to imagine it, but he was the most successful. So anyways, this idea that species change over time, going back to the fossil record now. What we see in the fossil record, it also includes the gradual emergence of entire genres of organisms. Angiosperms come after gymnosperms, for example. Placental mammals come after egg-laying mammals. Birds come after, they are more recent than reptiles, for example. So the fossil record is unambiguously structured in this way, but what supporting evidence is there for that sort of conclusion? That if organisms are produced from reproduction and the organisms of the past are different according to the fossil record, then does evolution really occur? Well, if we remember that taxonomists can classify living organisms or extinct organisms into groups based on their characteristics. So an example of how that works out in the history of studying evolution is birds appear to be the descendants of certain theropod dinosaurs. So there should be a missing link. Charles Darwin made that prediction, and just a couple years after he published On the Origin of Species, we found Archaeopteryx. We also have Hesperornis. There are multiple, quote-unquote, missing links or transitions for birds. We also now know, with respect to birds, but we did not know this in the 19th century, that raptors, the theropods that birds evolved from, they were completely covered in feathers. So that explains why birds also contain feathers. It's not just a coincidence. And we also now, in the modern day, know that birds are more closely related to reptiles than any other group of organisms. So that's a specific example, but it goes on and on like this for just all forms of life that we've been able to study in the same kind of detail. Scientists predicted the degree of relatedness between species decades before we had the technology to do that with genetics. So this provides not only a test for how to confirm evolution, but also how to disprove evolution. Evolution would have actually been really easily disprovable. All that would have had to have happened was for weak, zero, or contradictory correlations between the genetic hierarchies between species, insofar as they match the taxonomic brackets that were set up before we even started doing genetics. So the only acceptable kind of result to disprove evolution, for example, would be humans sharing zero genes with the great apes or zero genes with any organism. The only way for two species to have zero relation between them is if they share zero genes in common. But obviously, that's not what happened. We do share genes with all life on this planet, And the amount of genetic similarities we have is exactly what you would expect based on those taxonomic brackets. We're most common with the great apes, less so in common with mammals in general, but we have more in common genetically with mammals than we do with any other kind of animal life on this planet, and so on. Another possible refutation for evolution would have been contradictory correlations with respect to genetics and taxonomy. So if there really were some genetic similarities between species, but they contradicted or they produced no correlation between taxonomic groups, then evolution would have essentially been disproven. If you could find that, yeah, humans and the other apes, they do share some genes, but then the apes are most similar to bananas than they are to any other form, any other animal. Well, no evolutionist would have said that, yeah, the banana and the ape are more closely related than the apes are to any other animals. So that's the kind of contradictory data I'm talking about that would have completely falsified evolution. But again, obviously, that didn't happen. The point is, we knew exactly how to disprove evolution, but that didn't happen. So tonight's debate isn't about a competing idea. It's about whether the evidence supports evolution. And I think it unambiguously does. Exactly what evolution predicted has come true countless times. So you can't really ask the question, if evolution were true, what would the evidence look like? And not respond with a description of the evidence we currently have. And in fact, evolution deniers who have a grasp of biology know this. And I actually have a clip of that I can show you. So I'll share this real quick, and then that'll be the end of my opening statement. And I didn't figure out. There we go.
Just to be sure, does it play audio? Did you want it to have the audio play?
Did I need to select that before I started sharing?
You did. Plus, it is something that copyright-wise, I would prefer if you narrated it instead of playing the exact audio. Is that possible?
Well, here. Okay.
This is a really high-pitched voice.
Yeah. I won't share the audio then. But as you can see here, and funny enough, Donnie, one of my interlocutors, is in this debate here. So I asked the question to Jerry Bergman here, who's an evolution skeptic. I said, if evolution was true, what would the fossil evidence look like? And they were having a very specific debate. The topic was, does the hominin fossil record support human evolution? You'll have to take my word for it, I guess, or I can bring up the closed captioning maybe here. But Jerry says, oh, well, the evidence would look like the evidence that we currently have. I don't know if I can skip. So yeah, Jerry, go ahead. I suppose if evolution was true, many of the fossils we found are probably what we'd expect to find. We find animals that have traits of humans, and we find animals that have traits of other primates. So I went a tiny bit over my time there trying to set that up, but that's basically it.
In addition to autographed copies of both my books and, of course, Spanky, I'm excited to announce that I now have stickers, tumblers, apparel, and more on my store. Take Spanky, the God-Defeating Penguin, and can you put that into a logical syllogism with you wherever you go now?
You got it. We'll kick it over to PhD Tony.
Sorry, I thought that it would be Donnie next.
Is that how you guys? Pardon, I missed that during.
Sorry, I'm okay either way, but that was my understanding. I'm just not sure. If you want me to go, I can go.
Oh yeah,
Tony, you can go. Yeah, because okay, Matt and I have ours connected, basically.
All right, no problem. All right, then just allow me to share.
You got it.
Is that coming through?
It is now, yes.
Yes, okay. So just let me play this, okay? So I just want to start with a comment, because this often comes up in debates, that lay people don't really understand peer-reviewed literature. There is an entire corpus of peer-reviewed studies in reputable journals. Many of those will later be shown to be an error. So let's restrict ourselves to the ones that haven't been shown to be an error. many of those are not validated by later studies. Now, if you take data from a reputable study that has been repeatedly validated but disagree with the interpretation, you are very likely simply incorrect. The very process of peer review and replication all but preclude the possibility that any alternative interpretation is valid. If you take hypotheses from otherwise reputable studies that haven't been replicated, you can't treat them as though they have equal weight to hypotheses that have been replicated. And if you take hypotheses or data from studies that have not been peer-reviewed in reputable journals, you cannot treat them as consistent with the literature. You cannot treat them as logically well-structured or having sound methodology. I'm not saying that they don't. I'm saying that that has not been tested. This is the value of peer-reviewed literature. Now, let's get back to the central question. If evolution were correct, what would we expect the available evidence to look like? We would expect a gradual progression from simple to more complex organisms through time. For example, we would expect a transition from invertebrates to vertebrates, with early skeletons mostly cartilaginous and not consisting of mineral bones. We would expect gradual convergence towards modern forms, though the convergence would not be uniform. If creation were correct, what would we expect the available observational evidence to look like? Well, we would expect sudden and spontaneous emergence of life forms without precursors. We would not necessarily expect chronological ordering since the progress of creation is arbitrary. There is no necessity in creation that things be chronologically ordered since the process of introduction of new life forms is entirely at the whim of the creator. We would not expect gradual convergence toward modern life forms since modern life forms were created in their present form ab initio. So what does the observational data set look like? Here's a simple timeline of the history of the Earth. We can get into the validity of geochronological techniques if my interlocutors wish. I'm well prepared to defend this timeline. Our first evidence of life on Earth comes from organic carbon that is low in carbon-13, in the isotope carbon-13, that is found in zircons at 4.1 billion years ago. So we have our first data point there. We also find stromatolites at 3.7 million years ago in Greenland. A stromatolite is a concreted structure that is formed by microbial colonies. These are preserved in the record and can be dated. So we've got our second data point here. We also see microbial mats. These are the earliest known marine microbial maps, and the terrestrial microbial maps only emerge about 2.4 billion years ago. So after about 1.6 billion years, we've gotten as far as microbial mats. We get to macroscopic fossils of life forms in the Ediacaran. This is about 635 million years ago, or about 4 billion years after our current estimates suggest the Earth finished forming. So now we're going to focus in on from the Ediacaran to the present. So now we're looking at a timeline of 635 million years. We see early on in this period the emergence of the Cambrian vertebrates like Hycoichthys. At about 510 million years, we see the emergence of the first insect at about 400 million years. We see evidence, this is footprint evidence of the first amniotes or the first reptiles, and we see that come in at about 350 million years. So we are seeing exactly what was expected. We are seeing gradual increase in sophistication of life forms, and we are seeing gradual convergence towards modern forms. The first mammals enter the that we're aware of in the fossil record have entered by about 160 million years. Our next jump-off point is the Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event, about 66 million years ago. Moving on from there, we see the first primates enter at about 55 million years. By 55 million years, the first primates are in the fossil record. The first apes enter at about 20 million years ago. The first hominins enter at about 7 million years ago. And it's important to note about these early ones. You can see in this figure, we've got chimpanzee on the left, modern human in the middle, and then Sahelanthropus, which is one of these early hominins, in the middle. And you can see the position of the foramen magnum. This is the point at which the vertebra enters the cranium. And you can see that for Sahelanthropus, it has an intermediate position in between the chimpanzee, which was not fully bipedal, and the modern human, which was bipedal. We can see this again in the hip bone and in dentition. So if you look at the bottom of this figure, you can see on the left, those are hip joint bones from Homo sapiens, Australopithecus afarensis, Ardipithecus ramidus, and Pan troglodytes. You can see that Ardipithecus ramidus and Australopithecus afarensis have very human-looking hip bones, whereas chimpanzees, Pan troglodytes, don't. If you look on the right, down the bottom, you can similarly see modern human foot on the top, where you have an inline big toe and you have a very rigid foot structure. Ardipithecus ramidus, for instance, does not have an inline big toe, but it does have a very stiff outer foot. So these are very human-like. These are very human-like properties. We can break this down even more. Let's look at a skeleton of Ardipithecus ramidus. Let's break down its human-like and its ape-like characteristics. It has small canines and a human-like teeth arrangement, so that's human-like. It has a very
A
small brain.
30-second warning.
That's ape-like. I'm almost finished. It has very long arms relative to its body, but it has bipedal hips. It has loose wrists, straight flexible fingers, and is not a knuckle worker. Its big toe is not in line, but its outer foot is stiff. So this is an example of something intermediate that is converging towards the modern form that humans eventually adopted. And I would argue that this is exactly consistent with what we would expect the fossil record to look like. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that opening. We are going to kick it over to. Oh, you got the screen scrambled. If you guys can do me a favor, even if 2 seconds before you start sharing your screen, even if you happen to be doing something illegal, please don't turn your camera off because otherwise it scrambles up the screen on me. Is let me just quickly rearrange the screen here as once someone turns off their camera. All of the faces of people get scrambled on screen. So I have to like fix it while we're doing the debate live. So with that, I want to remind folks, people, if you haven't yet been to Modern Day Debate, we are a fully neutral platform hosting debates on science, religion, and politics. We hope you feel welcome. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button as we have many more debates coming up. And if you have been living in a cave on Mars with your fingers in your ears and you didn't know, Modern Day Debate will be hosting DebateCon 6 this fall. You don't want to miss it. It's our in-person debate conference. It's 2 days long. It's in Nashville, Tennessee on November 15th and November 16th. Tickets are linked in the description box below. Check out those tickets now. And again, November 15th and 16th, it's coming very fast, folks. Don't put it off. Book your tickets now, as well as book your flights now. Most of the people that have signed up are actually flying in. No joke, only about 5% of the people that have bought tickets so far are from like Nashville itself. So the vast majority are from outside of Tennessee. With that, thank you very much, gentlemen, in particular. Big Don, the floor is all yours for your opening.
Thank you very much, James. It's an honor to be here on Modern Day Debate. And thank you to Planet Peterson and PhD Tony for accepting this debate on biological evolution on trial. You can find many answers to questions on the topic of origins here at our website, sanfortruthministries.com. I've written a couple books related to the topic at hand. Special creation goes
2 seconds.
into.
If you want to share your screen, please do so now.
Yes. Let me get back here.
Folks, don't forget to hit that like button if you are here and you're enjoying this debate, which obviously you're enjoying it because it's awesome. Hit that like button. We do appreciate it. And the floor is all yours, Don.
Thank you, James. Okay. And so, as I was saying, here are a couple books that I have written that's related to the topic at hand, special creation, where I get into the scientific evidence for special creation and the biblical model of ancestry going into mitochondrial DNA, Y chromosome DNA that points us right back to an origin of two people. Y chromosome Noah and mitochondrial Eve. This one here, the Endogenous Retrovirus Handbook, I provide a comprehensive response to the so-called best evidence for evolution, endogenous retroviruses, showing that they are mostly created units of DNA function and not the ancient vestiges of past viral infection. Tonight, the burden of proof, what this debate is and what it is not. The charge tonight is biological evolution, not the age of the Earth. The affirmative, Planet Peterson and PhD Tony, who just gave their opening statement, must demonstrate that the mechanisms of evolution are adequate to explain the origin of biodiversity. Are humans and banana plants related through common descent, as our interlocutors assert? This is their burden. Scientific evidence that can be explained by both models, creation and evolution, for example, is agnostic, non-differentiating. And we'll get into the specifics of what that means in a bit. For our opponents tonight, to meet their burden of proof, meeting a high evidential threshold, they must provide evidence that can only be explained or best explained by common descent. Can they do this? And I'll say right off the bat that it's genes, traits, and genetics that are inherited sperm and egg, not a rock, not a fossil. And so, unfortunately, for our interlocutors, focusing too much on the fossil record is not the direct way to answer the question of ancestry. And we've had many seasoned evolutionary biologists admit the same thing, that it's in genetics and biology that we best answer this question. If they cannot provide discriminatory evidence, they've failed to establish common descent as the best explanation for origins. Our task is to test our interlocutors' claims and reveal where the evidence is agnostic, contradictory, or just speculation. Just like in a courtroom, if the case doesn't meet the burden, the verdict is clear. We don't necessarily have to provide a superior model for this debate. We just need to raise enough doubt for the jury to decide that the affirmative, like a prosecutor in a courtroom, has failed to meet their burden. Now, we have taken the affirmative and we've defended the position of biblical creation many times before. We recently debated conspiracy cats on Adam, Eve, and biblical creation. And so, if you're looking for a debate on that topic, that could be one for you to enjoy. Now, the question is, and I've already seen it come up in the live chat, what do we mean by evolution? If by evolution we simply mean change over time, or the technical definition of evolution, which is changes in allele frequencies, an allele being a genetic variant in populations over generations, then we're not really going to have anything to debate tonight. And so I'm sure we would all agree that domestic dogs, coyotes, wolves can be traced back to a common ancestor. For that, we won't disagree. But if by evolution, which is what our interlocutors mean here tonight, that domestic dogs, wolves, coyotes, and banana plants are related through common ancestry, that is where we have an issue. And so here's a tree of life, why we are related to every little living thing, bacteria, humans, fish, all being traced back to a universal common ancestor. The opposing model, an opposing model, I should say, is separate ancestry, which would say that not all life is related through common ancestry. Now, the problem for the evolutionists is their drivers, their mechanisms here tonight, mutations, natural selection, genetic drift, gene flow, recombination, so on and so forth. Mutations are overwhelmingly deleterious. And to them, that is the ultimate source for all genetic variation. Natural selection is limited, it can't see the majority of mutations. Therefore, they drift. They degenerate, they accumulate over time, since selection can really only see the biggest mutations and get rid of those and amplify your best rare beneficial mutations. The mutation rate is high. For example, it's roughly in autosomal biparentally inherited nuclear DNA, it's roughly 100 new mutations per person per generation. and the majority of those are unselectable. Here, right from the conventional literature, in summary, the vast majority of mutations are deleterious. This is one of the most well-established principles of evolutionary genetics. Now, the evolution and creation models, they do have a lot of overlap. And so this is where I want to touch on briefly the point related to discriminatory and non-discriminatory evidence. So imagine we have two Earths. Perhaps the multiverse is true, Marvel DC style. Earth one, creation's true. Earth two, evolution's true. Okay, there's many points that are actually agnostic to the overall debate. Okay, if I were to say, well, creation's true because the sky is blue, well, the evolutionists would say, well, no, the evolution model can account for that as well. Or if I were to say creation is true because the earth is round, well, the evolutionary model would say that they can account for the same thing. And so this is why discriminatory evidence is so important. Pieces of evidence like homology, the shared structures seen in the biological world, that would fall under the category of agnostic. Because even if we were on Earth 2, where apparently evolution's true, well, homology could also be accounted for by the design hypothesis through common design. It's really no surprise that humans and chimpanzees share similar DNA. Both species breathe oxygen, metabolize food, and repair cells. Processes requiring many of the same proteins. So shared function requires shared coding. And shared coding points to common design, not necessarily common descent. My question to our interlocutors here tonight is, where in the evolutionary literature did scientists predict such strong homologous and nested hierarchical patterns in genetics? Because if we've been accumulating mutations for hundreds of thousands to millions of years, then what we would expect is more scrambling. We wouldn't expect to find such strong signatures like the nested hierarchical patterns that Eric discussed and brought up in his opening statement. And so here's a visual that I put together, 14 pieces of evidence for evolution, going through each with quick responses, ERVs, pseudogenes, so on and so forth. When it comes to homology, for example, humans design in homologous patterns. Why shouldn't God? Nested hierarchies, okay, humans share a lot more in terms of genetics, anatomy, physiology, and morphology with the chimpanzee than humans do with a fish or a bacteria. Well, we see the same thing in the design world, where a sedan shares a lot more with the hatchback than it does with, let's say, an airplane, a boat, or a skateboard. And so we see hierarchies by design. And so that's why largely these pieces of evidence are agnostic to the overall debate. Planet Peterson discussed a lot about transitional fossils, like synapsids, for example. Again, this is another agnostic piece of evidence. We also have hard to classify vehicles that could be looked at as the perfect transitional. For example, you have the invention of the crossover SUV, where it's not quite a van, it's not quite an SUV. It blends the features of both. And so what we're looking at here is good design, the 1961 Amphicar. The military has invented the military amphibious assault vehicle built for the transitional environment between sea and land. And so transitional forms versus mosaics, therapsids was brought up by Eric. We see the same thing in man-made designs. These are purpose-built mosaics. When it comes to DNA, this is a major challenge for the evolutionists. Incredibly, we have 6 feet of DNA in every single one of our cells. God is an amazing packaging engineer. Now, if life were simple, common descent might have a chance. Life is not simple. It is incredibly complex, which makes the evolutionary process that much more difficult. Now, I do need to hand it to Matt in 30 seconds. So I did want to run through a couple of these slides that showcase the best evidence for evolution has been overturned. Pseudogenes, we understand, are necessary to sustain healthy life processes in the cell. Endogenous retroviruses, functional in determining cell types. Embryological development, they function in the immune system. But the most important issue that I want our interlocutors to engage here today is, here's a differentiating line of evidence. These are the Y chromosomes of the great apes and humans. If you actually compare the human Y over here with the chimpanzee Y, The chimpanzee Y is half the size. It's missing the entirety of its heterochromatic arm. And when you consider overall gene content, size differences in architecture, the human Y and the chimpanzee Y are less than 30% the same. Those are massive differences that Tony and Eric are forced to account for in the evolutionary time frame. And speaking of the nested hierarchy that Eric speaks of, it actually turns out that the human and gorilla Y are more similar to each other than the either are to the human and chimpanzee Y. And so there's a break in the so-called nested hierarchy. And okay, Matt, let's throw it over to you, brother. You look like you got roughly 5 minutes.
All right. Let me know when I can go, or are we already on the clock?
All right. On the clock, although I can give you that 10 seconds or so back and we can see your slides.
Okay, thank you. So over time, mutations build up in the mitochondria. If deep time was true, mutation saturation would be expected. If young Earth creation were true, very few mutations would be found. Nathaniel Jensen at AIG predicted low mutation saturation. So what happened is he said, okay, well, if we split about 7 to 8 million years ago or 17 million years ago, mutations would have accumulated massively about that amount of time. Matter of fact, we should find about 21,457 over that time. But in reality, we only found 1,483. The biggest proponent named Ivo Grad actually admitted that's true. 12,000 differences would still be far too many. All he was doing was complaining about the chart itself. We found the same thing in bears, whales, goats. He published in humans, fruit flies, everything's basically the same. That actually is exactly the same thing in the nuclear DNA. There should be more. The study published by Kondrashov says, why are we not dead 100 times over? And they admit this in the literature. They say, it is thought we split from a common ancestor 5 to 6 million years ago, more than enough time for substantial genetic differences to develop, but yet they're not there. So what does that mean? Mutation accumulation is one example that puts a limit on the genome. And since the experts themselves have no answer to this question, our debate opponents are going to have a hard time answering it themselves. Next, the Neanderthal extinction dilemma. They ran a study and they said, well, Neanderthals shouldn't have lived for even 10,000 years. So based on population size, Rethinking Neanderthal said that there was about 10 to 15, including counting children, and the most you can find is about 20 individuals. Well, by going by the study, we actually find that if you go to 10 to 15 to 20 individuals, they could only have lived for about 500 to 1,000 years. That's not very long. So the question is how could they have lived for 400,000 years on Earth if they can't even live for 1,000 based on their population size? So the inbreeding problem is yet another example that puts a limit on the genome. And again, if the discrepancy between the fossil record and the genetic evidence hasn't been solved by the experts. So again, let's see what they have to say. We find the exact same problem when we compare the fossil record again with the genetic data. The evolutionary model has the mutation rates from the fossil record called the phylogenetic mutation rate. It's based on the fossil record and assumptions of a split. But what do we actually find? Well, the same thing. When we go to mutation rate clocks, they only go back about 6,500 years for the most recent common ancestor of all people. That's 20 times faster than the evolutionary prediction on fossils. This rate is used by the FBI, so clearly it works. And multiple other studies on humans have found the exact same thing. But it gets even worse for them because this fast rate is also found in all animals that have ever been studied. Here's one on chickens. The rate was 15 times faster than expected. And right here, the substantially higher than the avian rate based on fossil calibrations. You add in extinction and how many animal bird families there actually are, 249, based on the population growth rate and how rapid speciation is and hybridization rate. You run those numbers, you get about 18,416 if you put a global flood about 5,000 years ago. And the new study confirms that there are about 18,000 species. Again, rapid speciation rates, exactly what we see, line up with the biblical timeline, not the evolutionary one. So we have rapid speciation rate that puts a limit on the timeline. Slow versus observed. So the discrepancy between the evolutionary assumptions of slow and hybridization versus the observed rapid rate puts another problem. We have the exact same thing in plants, by the way. It's fast. Why does this matter? Because if mutation rates are fast and they were required to be slow, it literally changes everything because evolution is based on mutation rates. So we have the FBI using them. They match historical events. They're used by young Earth creationists to make testable predictions. They're found in all animals, insects, reptiles, basically anything ever tested. They land on the young Earth creation timeline and never the evolutionary timeline. Wonder why that is. So mutation rates, another great example that puts a limit on the timeline. And the observational rates always disagree with the evolutionary rates that are based on radiometric dating and fossils. Interesting, huh? So the discrepancy that's there is exist, and I would love to know what our interlocutors have to say about it, because the experts have never solved this one. Again, they have no idea. Early in the 1940s, zoologists predicted and believed that population below just a few dozen were doomed. Why? Because of inbreeding, something that's made fun of a lot on Young Earth Creationists. They got off and all the animals had to inbreed. They should not have lived because they were having sex with one another, and there is no possible way. Well, Nathaniel Jensen actually predicted multiple speciation rates, hybridization rates, mutation rates. What do we see? Guess what? Wild sheep dropped off by just a single pair. Unexpected heterozygosity increase. Exactly. Unexpected by evolutionary predictions. We find the same thing with stick insects, with birds, with rabbits. 24 dropped off, are now 200 million today. 4 deer dropped off, only 1 male. Today, you can hunt them to extinction if you can try in New Zealand because they can't be killed fast enough. Then we have 14 bison dropped off an island. There's 600 today. They've run out of resources. They have no problems. 7 lionfish turned into an ecological disaster. 5 adult lizards dropped off, no problem. Wolves, a single pair dropped off. Again, no problem. So what do we see? Small founding numbers, exactly like the Bible said, would have got off the ark and repopulated. Evolution said was impossible, not true, couldn't happen. Well, the observations of rapid population growth and expansion from a founding population refute evolutionary predictions and again confirm the biblical timeline. We see the same theme over and over. Here's another one on why mitochondria should define species. What did they actually discover? Researchers found a telltale sign showing that all animals emerged at the same time. Interesting. Maybe a global flood? Anyway, what else did they find? And another unexpected finding was that species have clear genetic boundaries and nothing much in between. The absence of in-between species was something that perplexed Darwin. Why? Because he thought one kind would turn into another. So again, this conclusion is very surprising, and I fought against it as hard as I could. That's what the author of the study discovered. So what do we have? Genetic boundaries with independent lines of ancestry, evidence of a global mtDNA bottleneck with low genetic diversity that's never been solved by the experts. So how are our debate opponents going to be answered to this one? I don't know. We'll have to see them try. Young Earth creationists love this. They jumped right on it. Every major organization published it because independent lines of ancestry.
I think you're coming to the end of your time, Matt.
What's that?
I think how much time does he have left, James?
Just hit the end of your time. Okay. I have to transition into the other team. However, we do have 8-minute rebuttal, so if you might be able to squeeze some of that in during the rebuttal.
I have a question.
That was funny. I talk fast. I'm good.
And then,
can you repeat the debate topic for us?
Is biological evolution supported by the evidence?
Okay, so is this about genetics, or is this about the biological evidence regarding evolution? Because if I had been informed that this was going to be a technical discussion of genetic evidence, I wouldn't have agreed to be here. So I feel like this is a bait and switch by my opponents in order to define themselves into a victory. This is not the debate topic that I agreed to discuss, or at least my opponents are not engaging with the evidence that I was informed would be considered.
Gotcha. What we'll do is we'll see if this will be a resolution that you all agree with. I'm open to trying different resolutions to be sure that we're on the same page. I've got the question typed for ChatGPT. I don't know the answer that ChatGPT is going to give. And if you guys are like, no, I don't like that method, just let me know before I hit submit. I typed in, does genetics fit under the umbrella of biological evolution? So we could have ChatGPT be kind of like the objective third party.
Sure.
Understanding, genetics is a fundamental and inseparable branch of biology. And so they're connected in such an important way to
discussing. Yes, but it's a specialization, right? You're insisting that we have to present genetic evidence. And you're denying the fact that other evidence is relevant or even...
I'm not saying it's not relevant. I'm saying the best way to determine the question of ancestry, to answer the question of ancestry, would be through genetics. but you still have the right to focus on fossils and other pieces of evidence if you think those are stronger or equal to genetics. You have no, you have that right, basically. But I'd be curious to see what ChatGPT says, James, if you wanted to do that.
You guys cool? Because we don't want to get too hung up on the, basically, we want a quick resolution so we can continue with the debate. Everybody happy with ChatGPT being like the objective answer of this question?
I mean, it's going to say yes, but
I'm going to say
it is going to say yes. But I mean, it feels like I've been asked into a debate which is admittedly already outside my area of expertise, and then my opponents are saying, well, it has to be about genetics. And if this were a genetics,
but it doesn't have to be about genetics. We're just stating a claim. We're making a claim that it's in the field of genetics that we best answer the question of ancestry. But if you want to go outside of genetics, you have that right. It is your burden of proof tonight, but you can focus on fossils all you want. We're not saying it's against the rules.
Well,
okay. So ChatGPT, as you guys predicted, did say yes, that genetics is under the umbrella of biological evolution. However, as Donnie had said, you know, you could reject his framing and say, like, well, like maybe it's a piece of the puzzle, but it's one of several or many pieces. So we're not going to give it more time than it deserves in our responses.
Okay, because just to put it on the record, I'm not an expert biologist, and I'm certainly not an expert in genetics. And if this was going to be the content, I'd have said get somebody better qualified to discuss it.
Well, but Tony, I just want to clarify, you were of the understanding, you were aware that the topic tonight was biological evolution on trial?
Yes, I was, okay. but I was not under the impression that this was going to be an exclusively genetic discussion.
The point is, Matt and I are framing, and as someone who's debated many evolutionary biologists, they've admitted to me, and I can pull up clips, that it truly is in the world of biology and genetics that we best answer this question of ancestry, as bones and fossils are in many ways low confidence, low quality science. But that doesn't mean you have to accept my framing, as James said. You have every right to go focus on fossils and basically, go ahead.
As long as the audience is aware that just because you say that we have to meet you on your terms is not a dictation. Okay, let's move forward.
One second. Duly noted, I just want to do a quick plug before we do jump into the rebuttals. First, I want to actually mention we will have short rebuttals, in particular 8 minutes per team, folks. Then we'll have our open dialogue, then 5 minute closings, and then we'll have Q&A. And if you haven't yet, hit that like button. We do appreciate your support. With that, thank you very much. Tony and Planet Peterson, the floor is all yours for your first rebuttal.
Do you want to go first, Eric?
Yeah, I suppose. I tried to jot down some notes. I was looking up sources during that, and there was a lot that was said, so I didn't get too many things. But I'll say a couple of short things. Donnie brought up what about creation? You know, in part of his opening statement, that's not the debate. The debate is, does the evidence support biological evolution? The evidence could literally, I guess, in theory, support two different models. If you're going to say, that could be evolution, but it also could be God, then you're just tacitly conceding the debate with that. So I don't want to have a creation versus evolution debate tonight, because that's what we didn't sign up for. I didn't hear either opponent give a single example of what would the evidence look like if evolution was true. I also didn't really hear any examples of what would the evidence look like if evolution was false. I want to see if we can get any of that. Another thing from when Donnie was talking, Donnie talked about the human Y and the chimp Y chromosomes not being as similar as maybe the evolutionists would say that they are, or something like that. But I mean, our Y chromosome, but what about the fact that the genome itself between humans and chimps is 98.6% similar? So you can't take, like, to just focus on the Y chromosome, which is a really tiny fraction of our genome, and say, well, this the 2% of the 98.6% doesn't look too good, huh? Therefore, throw out 99%, 98% or whatever your data. I don't think that's really an honest tactic. And like the idea that our Y chromosome is more similar to the gorilla than the chimp, that was another thing that was brought up. Okay, again, what about the entire rest of the genome? And then Matt, you said too many things, but like mutation saturation would be expected under evolution, blah, 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 blah. Who says this? Evolutionary biologists or creationists? And what are they basing this on? Geneticists don't really think that this is a problem, and I wonder why that would be. A couple of things that happened, I'm going to share my screen here real quick, was, can everybody see this?
Yes.
So this is actually the debate that we're in right now. I pulled it up on YouTube. Wow. So we have stuff about here, like mitochondrial DNA differences between humans, and somehow this doesn't work. But then this goes on to, I don't remember specifics. I was going to try to play it back to hear it, but when Matt's talking about, oh, there's contamination in the genome, it doesn't evolve fast enough, it evolves too slowly or something like that. And then he goes on like to support that with this study, which is selectively cropped. I don't know why Matt thought this supports him. I actually found this actual article. It's talking about a genetic bottleneck event that occurred in humans, the Toba eruption. This is a pretty well-known thing. At this point, in no way does this short article here support anything that he was trying to argue for. And now this thing is in my way.
It certainly contradicts the young Earth claim.
Yeah, I've looked at some of this stuff before, like he brings up the mitochondrial stuff. Guys, real geneticists know that this isn't a problem. When you get hacks like Robert Carter that write these papers that they can't get peer reviewed. Tony was talking about this. The Eve mitochondrial consensus sequence. Okay, look at what it says. In order to develop a biblical model of human genetic history, we created a corrupted model and fudged all the data to make it work for us. This is absolutely not proper science. This violates peer review, as Tony was talking about earlier. So these are the kinds of things that happen. And then I'll try to be real quick here, but Matt said something about, oh, there weren't enough Neanderthals in order for the Neanderthal population to have survived. Okay, if that's the case, then Adam and Eve being two people weren't enough people. So the whole biblical model of human beings being able to exist completely falls apart. And Noah's incest family after the flood completely falls apart too. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that there weren't enough Neanderthals, therefore it's disproven, and then believe in something that's vastly worse. And then there was stuff about the mutation rates are too slow. Well, then there goes the possibility of speciation post Noah's flood. There were only a handful of species on that boat compared to the over 1.5 million that we've documented today. And that doesn't even include extinct ones. Those are just the extant ones. So as Tony said earlier, it's just a contradictory argument. And I'll give the rest of our time for Tony because that's all I wrote down.
Okay. Donnie made a couple of claims that are absolutely false. Function is not genetically driven. If that were true, fishes and dolphins would have very similar genomes and they don't. Bats and birds would have very similar genomes and they don't. So the claim that things with similar forms represent similar use of the same code is absolutely untrue. The claim that the claim that creation should be accepted. Creation is an inherently unscientific hypothesis because despite the claims of our interlocutors, it doesn't make good faith predictions. It makes claims that are in accord with the observational evidence and then says, see, we predicted that. That's not science. The first point that I made on coming here was to point out that you can't cherry-pick bits out of a corpus of academic papers where all of the reviewers, all of the people who have published the papers, and all of the people who have replicated the papers and expanded on the results disagree with your interpretation and then say, look, the mainstream agrees with us. No, they don't. If that were the case, you would have simple publications where it was stated by subject matter experts that they agreed with the creation model. You don't have that because it doesn't exist, because they do not agree with your interpretation of their data. Which, again, as I explained, if the peer reviewers, the authors, and the entire discipline engaging with the literature disagree with your interpretation, your chances of being correct are infinitesimally small. And to just ignore that and continue cherry picking seems less than scrupulous. So natural selection acts against this so-called mutation saturation. Mutation, if an organism gains too many deleterious mutation, it will be at an evolutionary disadvantage. So to claim that we expect this mutation saturation is nonsense. Environmental selection will filter out everything where there's too much deleterious stuff. The claim that all, the claim that the vast majority or the majority of mutations are deleterious is very different from saying all. All mutations are not deleterious. There exist beneficial
30
mutations,
seconds.
and these respond favorably to the environment. And at no point in their discussions did our interlocutors recognize the importance of environmental pressures on their interactions with genetic drift or genetic development. Also, finally, the fact that life is complex argues against design. And also, there are
And
ways of writing different code to do the same thing. There are
time.
completely different codes to sort numbers, for instance.
We will jump over to Standing for Truth and Raw Matt for their 8-minute rebuttal as well. Folks, if you haven't yet, hit that like button. We appreciate your support.
James, thank you very
Yes.
much, brother. Allow me to set my timer. Matt, I'll take the first roughly four, and then you take the second half. And so, okay, let me get my timer started here. Starting now. Okay, few things to respond to. Largely, what we're dealing with here is fossils, the ordering of the fossil record. I do want to respond to something Tony just said. Yes, the overwhelming majority of mutations, all population geneticists would agree to this, are deleterious and nearly neutral because now we understand that the majority of the genome is functional. We have at least 80% evidence for activity, biochemical activity. That activity is not just spurious. Every time you add a single nucleotide to a growing RNA chain, you're consuming energy, you're consuming ATP. And so now the evolutionists over time have underappreciated just how functional the genome is. Since the genome is more functional than ever understood, that means even more mutations are deleterious. The vast majority of beneficials are reductive. I'm not saying they're all reductive, but the majority of them are reductive, and they simply can't counterbalance the damage done through the relentless influx of slightly deleterious mutations. And so, okay, ordering of the fossil record in some transitional fossils. Let's go point by point through Eric. I do appreciate the opening statements. Organisms are different in the fossil record than today. Well, of course, organisms change today. Organisms have changed in the past. Organisms adapt to their environments. And what we see based on the incredible functionality of the genome is that biological organisms have been front-loaded with the pre-existing ability to change in the first place. Early synapsid. Synapses, these so-called mammal-like reptiles I went through in my opening statement. Several of these examples, we could discuss Tiktaalik, the synapsids, we could discuss a whole number of interesting mosaics. That's all we find in the design world. And I think Eric missed the point, is that the burden of proof is on them. All we need to do is raise a little bit of doubt. And there's many models, It doesn't even have to be the young Earth creation model. There's many other models that can account for this agnostic data. These mosaics are one of them. Platypus, for example, combines mammal traits with reptile-like traits. Clearly a mosaic, yet no one calls it transitional. We find in the design world interesting mosaics, the crossover SUV, for example, military amphibious assault vehicle. Anyways, we're looking at purpose-built mosaics. And this is agnostic. It's not differentiating evidence. As I said, bones are not inherited sperm and egg. Tony doesn't like that. Well, that's his problem, I guess. We've debated many geneticists and biologists, and they've all conceded that, yes, fossils are fickle. They can tell any story that you want. Obviously, the direct evidence is in genetics. Here's another problem. We know that there oftentimes exists more variation within species than across species. But luckily, today, we have breeding tests. We can test their genomes. But in fossils, for the most part, you don't have genomes to sequence, and you can't do a breeding test, clearly. And so it is important that we focus on genetics, because that's the best way to determine ancestry. There's many problems with the fossil record. A major problem has to do with the limits of determining what is and what isn't closely related. What's the result of convergent evolution and homology? They ask or mention the ordering of the fossil record. Well, here's a major challenge, okay? Even evolutionists will look to regional separation and burial by ecosystems, according to ecosystems. For example, the coelacanth. There are many living fossils. The Willemi pine comes to mind. Here in the slide, you can see a coelacanth, a whale. They both live in water environments, a T-Rex and a human. Well, it was thought for 65 million years that apparently the coelacanth, and yes, there is some morphological variation in coelacanths today versus in the past, but anybody can tell that they're both coelacanths. Organisms change over time, but these, the evolutionists were debating, they want to extrapolate this. This is an extrapolation fallacy to mean that fish and humans are related, and bring in banana plants too. Okay, so 65 million years, it's assumed that coelacanths are extinct. All of a sudden, we see them swimming around in the oceans today. In the early 1900s, I believe, is when we discovered this. Well, wait a minute. Coelacanths, according to the evolutionary model, have coexisted with whales, have coexisted with dolphins, but we don't find them buried together. Isn't that interesting? Or coelacanths live with humans today, but we don't find them buried together. And so the best explanation, really, for what we see in the so-called ordering of the fossil record is burial by very specific regions. We've had geologists on the channel who have worked in the field, and when they dig up fossils, they find mixed environments, plants mixed with sharks, mixed with land animals. We see stasis. We see a lot of problems in the fossil record. And again, fossils are fickle. It's low quality, low confidence science. And so, Matt, that's exactly 5 minutes, brother. You got 3 minutes. Go ahead. Matt, you might be on mute, but I'm sure James will stop the timer until you.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm new to this one. All right. 3 minutes. They mentioned that it does. We don't make very good predictions, and evolution did. Actually, if you look into those predictions, you'll find devastating answers to those very things. Evolution has failed drastically when it comes to predictions. Stanley E. Salta here, who's a PhD and taught evolutionary biology, even mentioned he stopped believing in Darwinian evolution because of the failed predictions down the line. So you ask, why in the world did evolution, what would it look like? Well, what they've done is they've retrofitted the data. They took the data after it already came out, and then they retrofitted to make it look like evidence. And why do they do that? Well, easy. Let's go back to predictions. It was brought up earlier. Well, what about genetic similarity and homology? Well, the very first prediction was right here, Ernest Mayr, in the early part of his life. He stated that the search for homologous genes would be quite futile in evolutionary close relatives. This was his exact statement. And he said, why? Because it would scramble the genome. Mutations scramble and change DNA. Therefore, we wouldn't expect genetic similarity if evolution was true, because over time, it would have erased genetic similarity. Then in 1975, in the creation model, genetic similarities were actually predicted by ICR founder Dr. Henry Morris. He even said, the same similarities are predicted on the basis of a common design and purpose, and it may yet be determined that all living organisms exhibit underlying DNA level properties reflecting unified patterns of functional design. Then in 1978, they found the first HOX genes in fruit flies. The exact prediction that evolution said they would not find ended up becoming true. And they said no biologist had even the foggiest notion that such similarities would exist between genes of such different animals. It was inescapable and stunning. Now we know that genetic sequences form function. When you see a telomere on the end of a chromosome, that function is padding. And we know that. And now we can make predictions on that. So that is why the evidence looks like it fits evolution, because when they fail a prediction, they go, ah, it's still proof for evolution. It can't be falsified. But then we go into the fossil record. Darwin predicted slow Darwinian gradualism. That's what it's called today. But what did we actually find? We found things all over the place. Disharmonious associations when we find warm tropical species mixed with ice age species. We find ghost lineages everywhere where they just arise out of nowhere, like cats. Where did big cats come from? We don't know. No ancestor. Same thing with bats. Where did they come from? We don't know. So what happened is we found a mess. It would only take one of these things to falsify evolution. But as you know, it's very plastic. It can fit anything. But here's where we really get into the nitty gritty. Tracks are always found before the organism that left them. Sometimes thousands or millions of years before. How could that be possible? We find trilobites leaving tracks in layers that they weren't even found in. They were found in upper layers. We say that that's because of a flood, that we can't trust the radiometric dates that they give. We find they bring up the Archaeopteryx, but that's a temporal paradox. How can you say that there's such good evidence for evolution when we find them before the ancestor that they supposedly evolved from existing? We find bird feathers way before we even find dinosaurs. So the fossil record is quite a mess. They say it's interesting. Instead of finding the slow, smooth progression of the Laurel and Darwin had expected of the fossil record, bursts of change, new species appearing out of nowhere. That's what we really find. How about he brought up therapsids. Did you know we actually found Cynodonte, which is lived before dinosaurs? This is what they would look like. Guess what? Humans saw them. And this is crazy because cave art depicts what they actually look like. And the scientists are stunned. They have no idea how or why they could have actually predicted and seen these types of creatures. And then they went to the region and they found evidence that they lived there. So what are they seeing? They're not pulling up fossils and putting them together and saying, yep, this is what the thing looked like. But yet they drew the skin and color and the teeth exactly what they look like. I mean, that's pretty incredible if you ask me. I like that one a lot. Homology, that was actually a biblical creationist that came up with the homology pattern. He actually said, based it on the archetype, that there was an original archetype, and he built a homology pattern based on Genesis by looking at the sea creatures and birds first and then land animals next. And he called that structuralism. So in his book, you can see the structural pattern that he said. And he said, you can follow the patterns all the way up into human beings. His exact words were the ideal original or fundamental pattern of which natural groups of animals or systems of organs have been constructed to modify of which the various such animals or organs to be referred, meaning he's talking about God being referred. The archetype points to a deep and pregnant principle, some archetypal exemplar of which has pleased the creator to frame certain things of life. So taxonomy and cladistics and homology are actually
time out.
Oh, we've got to jump into the open dialogue. Okay. So I'm going to transition us in as I do want to mention, folks, if you haven't seen it, as you can see at the bottom right of your screen, we have channel memberships. A lot of you guys didn't know we have channel memberships, but we do. And they're pretty epic. So if you check those out right now, we have three tiers. At the middle tier, the debater level, you get access to our members only playlist, including over 350 debates, some of which are our most controversial and or kooky topics, like whether or not the Titanic sank or whether or not Bigfoot exists. With that, we're going to jump into the open dialogue. We've got the timer set for you, gentlemen. The floor is all yours.
Eric, if you don't mind, can we go back and forth a little bit on, because I think you made some interesting points in response to the Y chromosome. Can I briefly cover why I think it is important as compared to whole genome comparisons and then maybe get your thoughts?
Go ahead.
Okay. So why I think, and perhaps we can go back and forth on the, because I know there's some debate on just how similar humans and chimpanzees are when we compare the entirety of the genome, your uniparentally inherited DNA compartments, autosomal nuclear DNA. We got to consider Y chromosome, mitochondrial DNA, and biparentally inherited DNA. You said 98%. There was a recent paper that came out where you look at the supplementary material, and it seems like when you consider everything, gaps, copy number variations that we're looking at using a different methodology, it's actually closer to 85%.
I'm aware of those.
Okay.
When you apply the exact same metric in that alternative sequence comparison, what you find is that a human only matches the reference genome of another human in the data bank by 93%.
Right.
So it's like, okay, if the number for us in chimp goes down, therefore we're not related, then we're not related to humans either, would
Right.
seem to
I think
be.
that's a
And
I think that's a very fair point.
also, even if it goes down between us and chimps, it still holds higher for us and chimps than it does for any other two organisms between the two of us, which is still consistent with evolution. But go on to the Y chromosome.
Okay, those are fair points. Firstly, the hierarchy stays the same. I agree with you, Eric. Chimps and humans are still going to be more similar to each other than they are to monkeys and fish and bacteria and so on and so forth. And very good observation you make. Also, when you bring in the gorillas, using that same methodology where you get the 85% in the supplementary material, it looks like intraspecies gorilla differences are about 15% as well, 85%. And so it's not a key argument that I use because it does come down to, and I think critics such as Gutsa Gibbon have made fair points on the issue that, okay, if we're going to go with the 85% number, well, now we have to admit that humans within themselves are 93% in some circumstances, and then gorillas within themselves are 85%.
What the Y chromosome thing?
Right. Okay. So with the Y chromosome, this is why I prefer to focus on the Y chromosome. It's uniparentally inherited DNA. It's passed on the father's side, as you know. And therefore, it lacks, for the most part, recombination, right? Because it doesn't have any chromosomal counterpart to recombine with and shuffle genes and so on and so forth. And so one might think that it's more stable, but yet, to the surprise of scientists, I'll focus on this visual here because I think for the audience, it's helpful to have a visual representation. You can see the human Y here. And then you can also see the chimpanzee Y. And these are not just small differences. Again, for the most part, lacks recombination. There might be a little bit of gene conversion or at the tips, okay? But the chimpanzee Y is half the size. It has lost the entirety of its heterochromatic arm. Heterochromatin is this densely packed kind of DNA that comprises largely repetitive sequences like satellite DNA. And so you can see on the image, it's color-coded, your light gray, heterochromatin in humans. The chimpanzee Y, it's basically not there. And so I guess my first question, what happened to it? Was it just randomly lost after the split? Or how is from the evolutionary position, how would you account not only for that difference, which I think is significant, but all the differences, Eric?
In the what all how do I account for all the differences in the Y chromosome?
Right. And it's
Your
different to whole genome because it lacks recombination. One might expect it should be more stable.
I actually don't understand the logic of that at all. I'm not a formally trained geneticist, but recombination to me would protect the Y chromosome from losing bits and pieces of it. I just don't see your logic in the Y chromosome being more protected if it's if it doesn't recombine. Any small change that accumulates in a Y chromosome doesn't have an X chromosome to cross over and maybe replace that with. Because during meiosis, when you have crossing, let's say you have two homologous pairs, maybe one of those arms of the chromosome loses a piece of it through a deletion that happens, but that's not a guaranteed to be passed on because what it will do is it'll cross over with its homologous
Isn't that just a
partner.
story, though, Eric? Because
No,
obviously
we
we
know
don't
that
have to,
crossing over happens.
we know it crossing over happens, but now you want to extrapolate that to a common ancestor here,
Yeah,
roughly 6 million years ago.
but you told me a story. You just said, and I'm just going over the logic of it. your story was the Y chromosome should not lose genes. Okay, well, that's just a story. If you want to call mine just a story, so is yours. But what I can do is I can tell you with what I know about genetics, how the Y chromosome shrinking over time is actually not surprising, considering that it doesn't undergo crossing.
Okay, so do we have any modern organisms that? Okay, so do we have any modern organisms that have lost the entirety of its heterochromatic arm? And it is a fact that recombination, we have these chromosomes that line up, basically break, and then recombine to form new chromosomal combinations quickly. That makes things a little more messy. Okay, so maybe in some instances, but I am curious, heterochromatin. Is there any modern any examples you can point to today in order to extrapolate here how the chimp lost the entirety of its heterochromatic arm? Have we seen that in species today that we've sequenced?
That's possible. I don't know of any specific examples, but what I can do, I can point you to a mouse study. It's actually not a new study. For some reason, I had never heard of it until recently. I'm scrolling through to see if I can find the actual paper for it so I can tell you about it. Let me just do a quick control F here. It's published in Nature. It's called Rapid Chromosocial Evolution in Island Mice. So basically, now it's not a specific example of the heterochromatin or whatever that was region. That's just a very niche one that I haven't heard of. But what they've found is these mice have undergone dramatic reductions in their overall chromosome numbers. Mice normally have, it's the house mouse, they normally have 40 chromosomes, but there are populations of mice on this island where some of them have only 22 or 23 chromosomes. Now, I haven't been able to look into it specifically here to see exactly how much reduction in the actual genome has occurred, because we're talking about a karyotype number here, but dramatic, and I can actually share my screen here real quick. This is just a quick snippet of it.
But I just want to understand your point though. So are you saying
I really only need like 5 seconds.
Okay.
Rapid chromosomal changes are observed in species in real time. It might not be exactly the example you're looking for, but if we can find examples of rapid chromosomal changes in populations happening, then you haven't produced like an unscalable barrier.
Okay, so you want to extrapolate the changes that we see, these rapid changes in chromosomes in mice, and I'm assuming one of those chromosomes being the Y chromosome has rapidly changed in mice?
I don't know exactly off the top of my head which chromosomes have fused, but there are 6, I think, different populations of different karyotype.
Okay, so you're looking at fusions, okay. But I'm discussing specifically the Y chromosome. When you consider overall gene content, size differences in architecture between humans and chimps, it is, especially in light of the data in 2024, where they have the most sophisticated genetic sequencing data now available in the Y chromosomes of humans and the great apes, it's less than 30% the same. The burden of proof is on you guys today to demonstrate why biological evolution is best supported by the evidence. That point right there is a point that should raise a little bit of doubt
because the Y chromosome doesn't hold as much
70%
weight.
70% is a little?
The Y chromosome is a fraction of a percent of the genome. And between us and chimpanzees, when you compare the entire genome, we're 98.6% similar. So the idea of what's going on in this tiny part casts doubt into everything else is just...
I'm going to interject here because...
Well, I just want to respond to that. And then, Tony, you can jump in, okay? Even in sequences, because you said that if you want to go with the 96 to 98% number... in whole genome comparisons, Eric. Okay, but even in similar sequences between humans and chimpanzees, we find differences in gene regulation, differences in gene expression, epigenetic. So even in sequences that are the same, we still find differences, but the Y chromosome, 70% different. If what you're saying is true that, well, you know, chromosomes change, we can look at other species, well, according to your model, humans today go back 100 to 200,000 years, right? You have the out of Africa event, and then people spread out to all parts of the globe, seizing dominion over the planet. That means you have a couple 100,000 years where human Y chromosomes are subject to change in isolation, geographical separation in humans. Why are all human Y chromosomes then basically the same? Very little variation, 99% the same. How come we don't find some random tribe on the globe somewhere, some person who's lost so much in their Y chromosome where they differ? How come there's such uniformity in human Y chromosomes?
I want to kick it over to either Planet Peterson or Tony, but we have to hear from it. If both of them want to go, we have to hear from both of them before Donnie goes again.
Yeah, I only need about 10 seconds. For what you just said, Donnie, humans have been around, Homo sapiens have been around in our paradigm for at a maximum like 300,000 years. You wouldn't expect to see populations with radically different Y chromosome structures in that amount of time, but us and chimpanzees diverged over 7 million years ago. So that's the response. Tony, go ahead.
I'll respect
James. I would point out also that in the level of environmental pressure that a group is subjected to has a strong influence on the rate of the rate of genetic drift, right? That the stronger the environmental pressure, the greater the selection capacity. And this seems to be something that is sort of missing from Donnie's analysis, is that he seems to view these things entirely in genetic terms and not at all in environmental terms.
Environment can change.
I want to give PC a chance to respond.
I was still talking. This feeds into your Matt's point about punctuated equilibrium in evolution, where if you get a change in the environment, you can get a rapid change in organisms as they start competing with one another in the new environmental conditions. And then once things stabilize, they remain stable. And in the quote he had up on his screen, it was stable for millions of years, showing once again that the literature directly contradicts his young Earth creationist viewpoint.
Tony, one point
on
at a time.
On a meta level, I'd like to point out, on a meta level, I'd like to point out that at some stage we have to be given an opportunity from being grilled about genetic evidence.
Well, the burden of proof is on you, Tony. So one point at a time.
Yes, Matt, but I have evidence other than genetic evidence, and I'd like to be able to present it.
Yeah, but what's interesting is since the burden of proof is on you, I would argue we've already brought up more than enough, like the Y chromosome, massive differences, and your storytelling isn't addressing anything to raise a little bit of doubt in the audience.
I want to give PhD Matt. Tony, though, a chance to make his case.
Well, I would argue in response to that.
All right, gentlemen, one sec. Forget, but Donnie, just because we've covered we've had about 19 minutes, almost 19 minutes
right.
of going on. So I do want to give a chance for a PhD. Tony.
Okay, let's do that. But then, and I don't want to hog the mic. So Matt, I'm going to mute and you feel free to engage because I'll be tempted. Okay. But Matt, this is a 2-versus-2. Jump in.
All right.
Okay. So I would make the argument that what we've seen from these about what we've seen from our interlocutors, particularly from Matt, is a rejection of deep time and a rejection of long time periods. Now, this seems to be critical because it is a vital component of Matt's claim that creationist predictions well agree with the observations. And I'd like to attack that component. Matt, when in the young Earth creationist timeline did 2 kilometers of glacial debris accumulate in Oman?
That's a Leonard Orr type of a question. I would imagine that following the flood, we have massive amounts of volcanism that would be starting the ice age that lasted for around 1,000 years. During that time, the ice age would have obviously massively dumped tons and tons of layers that we would see at the Greenland and Antarctica. So we say that because the oceans were warm and because the temperature was cooler in the air, that we would be forming massive amounts of ice sheets during that earlier stages.
Is your claim that Oman is in Antarctica or Greenland?
Oh, That's not what I prepared for on this one. I was not going for I scores on this one. I was mostly focusing on the genetic stuff. So I don't have any
So
I
there is
scores.
so you, it's not ice cores, sir. It's when you drill down into the earth, we can see buried at a couple of kilometers deep, we can see 2 kilometers worth of glacial debris. Your task now is to explain how, since young Earth creationism seems vital to your line of argumentation, that your predictions are well supported by the evidence, you now have to defend how did that 2 kilometer of glacial debris get to Oman? And I will point out that once you're done there, we can start with Australia, we can go to China, we can go to Namibia. Because they're the snowball Earth glacial deposits are global in distribution. They're not localized near the poles. So off you go.
All right, but the thing is we already have the confirmed predictions. The predictions were all throughout the genetics. I had the head-to-head one showing genetic similarity, all of them, and I was
Yes,
just
but
showing that.
if your base assumption is shown to be false by other observations, then that isn't a valid prediction, is it?
I need to jump in, and then we'll throw it back to you, Matt. Tony, if you remember from my opening statement, what this debate is not is the age of the Earth. Ice cores. In case you forgot, there are old Earth creationists. I can name many right now. Frank Turek comes to mind, who reject biological evolution, but they're also old Earth creationists. They would reject young Earth creation. The majority of pieces of evidence that we provided in our presentation from biology, from genetics, even my response to you, I'm almost done. Even my response to your point on the ordering of the fossil record, okay, that none of that depends on a young Earth. So the debate is not on
No,
the
but
age of the
Matt's
earth. If you want
arguments
that
do.
debate, set it up.
No, but Matt's arguments do. Matt's arguments that his that the creation hypothesis is more plausible relies exclusively on the accuracy of the young Earth creationist. Your presentation didn't. Matt's arguments do. They rely, he presented multiple lines claiming that the young Earth creationist hypothesis is more consistent with the biological evidence that we see. And now we're and now you don't get to introduce this is my argument, and I just have to accept that there's no counter argument, that I can't present the counter argument to his. He made an argument that was specifically dependent on young Earth timelines. If you didn't want him to do that, you should have established that before the debate. I'm responding to what Matt said in his presentation.
Okay, that's a fair point if it directly pertains to an argument that Matt made. Matt, what's your response, brother? Go ahead.
My response is that my entire opening was literally all genetic evidence. My reply later was to his. He said that, the fossil record, he wanted to bring that up. I'll answer his opening. That's fine. We don't have to just stay on genetics. But my opening was literally only genetics. It covered all of these things. It was specifically.
Do you deny saying that the genetic evidence is consistent with a young Earth creation and is therefore, and therefore young Earth creation is to be preferred, that the creation is to be the preferred hypothesis because it agrees with the genetic evidence? Did you
Exactly.
say that?
Genetics confirms it and it falsifies the evolutionary phylogenetic fossil record. So you say the fossil record is
Not if
more
I can
accurate.
independently, not if I can independently refute your claims about a short timeline. If I can independently refute your claims about a short timeline, then the genetic evidence becomes spurious.
No,
But
it's
the
actually the
genetic
other way
evidence is
around
the
because genetics is the direct way to answer the question of ancestry. Okay. Glacial deposits are not inherited sperm and egg. Fossils are not inherited sperm and egg. Rocks are not inherited sperm and egg. It's actually a reality, Tony. Sorry to say for you. The genetic data would overturn your arguments or assumptions based on dating methods or glacial deposits or ice cores or whatever you want to bring up in a debate on the age of the Earth. Again, your
So
burden is
no,
biological evolution.
that's completely you're contradicting your own position. You said earlier that if a hypothesis is consistent with both, Right. If both branches of the hypothesis are consistent with a branch of data, then you have to use exclusive evidence to determine whether or not one of the hypotheses is true. Now you're saying that even though both hypotheses are capable of explaining the observations, your claim, Matt's claim, is that the shorter timeline means that the young Earth creationist hypothesis is to be preferred. I am challenging that assertion because we have abundant independent evidence arguing that a young Earth timeline is simply physically impossible. There's no way you can get the glacial deposits in Canada, in Death Valley, in Namibia, in Australia, in Oman, in Svalbard. There's no way you can get those, kilometer thick glacial deposits there and then put, tens of meters of carbonaceous capstone on top of them and then get hundreds of meters of sediment on top of that in thousands of years.
Okay,
It's
let's
just
hand it to Matt then to
realistic,
address
and we
that.
can and we can and therefore Matt's argument that the young Earth creationist timeline is even a viable hypothesis is rejected. And
All right, let's go
I'd
back to
like
Matt.
to. Okay, let's go.
But Matt, before you respond, the hypothesis in question is biological evolution. So the discriminatory data that we would expect to receive in a debate like this would be that which supports biological evolution. At best, you'd have an old Earth without common descent. So you still would
Okay,
not
but
meet your
then
burden
Matt
of
was
proof.
wrong to claim, then Matt was wrong to claim that he has evidence of a young Earth and that that makes his hypothesis more persuasive because
It would
intrinsically a
only
young Earth
remove.
makes his hypothesis less persuasive because it can be easily disproven.
It would only remove the young Earth point, but
Yes.
it would okay, but it would not remove separate ancestry or the points against common descent. So to be fair though, Matt, feel free to engage what Tony is saying, and then perhaps we can move on to another point. I will say Mike Ord, who's a meteorologist and atmospheric scientist who's studied this issue for many years, dozens of years. We've done full presentations and seminars with him on this very issue, but I'm reluctant to go down too deep on it because I do want to keep it to biological evolution. But Matt should have the right to defend himself. So Matt, go ahead.
Sure. So the goal of evolution theory is to be able to explain the diversity of life on Earth. Now, evolution has always assumed that mutation rates are slow. We say they are rapidly fast. We find out that they are fast observationally. And when we compare them to the fossil record, which says that they're old, and we look at the radiometric dates and they say they're old and they do not agree, which one are we going to go for? Because Donnie was right. Theoretically, the Earth could be old, but does it, but what does the genetic data present? It shows everything is young. So if it's young, then it actually shows that there is evidence that the Earth is young based on that. That's what I was using as the analogy.
Where are you getting the claim that evolution claims that mutation rates are slow?
Exactly.
Oh, they
Where is
predicted
that
they were
coming
slow
from?
very early on. It's called the phylogenetic mutation rate, and it's based off of they made the prediction
Then,
early in the 90s.
okay, but surely you understand now that we have periods of punctuated equilibrium, right? In those the where static and slow variations are punctuated by extremely rapid evolutionary events. This is completely consistent with evolutionary theory, right?
But you would need actually a bottleneck for to reset genetic diversity for it to be young, and there would be no bottleneck 6,500 years ago in the evolutionary model to explain all of the fast mutation rates we see that go back to that time period. When would the most recent common ancestor in these studies lived about the biblical
Matt,
timeline about 6,000 years ago,
that
right?
is
Who
nonsense.
told you that there was a bottleneck 6,500 years ago?
There would have to be one based on the genetic evidence.
Who told you that? Where do you get that from?
From the pedigree mutation rate studies. So, when we study animals, their mutation rate goes back to a most recent common ancestor, like the female, like mitochondrial Eve, just 6,500 years ago. But you can only get a female.
I've never heard anybody except a creationist say that before. You're
Oh,
telling me for all life on the planet, when we study the when we analyze the mitochondrial DNA of all life on the planet, regardless of species, it all points to holy crap, the molecular clock analysis or whatever, the comparative mitochondrial whatever between, it all goes back to 6,500 years ago. Where did you hear this? This is the most made up thing I've ever heard.
Are you familiar with the Rockefeller study, Eric, that Matt has pointed to, the genetic boundary study?
I haven't heard of this specific one.
Okay. Well, they pointed out in the study, you looking at the mitochondrial DNA, Matt, maybe you can pull it up. I know you got a whole presentation on it. Looking at a highly conserved mitochondrial DNA protein, the CO1 gene, they discovered very low diversity across all of the biological world and concluded that all of extant species, all species basically came into existence at the exact same time. And when you look at the genetic data, not the assumptions based on the geological rock record, that genetic data is consistent with roughly 4,000 to 6,000 years.
What's the name
of
the study?
Could you present this publication?
Here. I'll go through just a few of them real quick for you. This one was done by Howell in the early 90s. He did the first mitochondrial D-loop sequence and found one substitution every 25 generations, a very fast mutation rate. And it was the first one ever. But they said, these people have a disease. It's probably not the best to test. So then along came Thomas Parsons. He ran a study in 1997 and followed by 1998. But the first one here, 1997, he found a most recent common ancestor of Eve. So he did a coalescence with all these other scientists to figure out when this most recent common ancestor for females lived. And sure enough, right there in the secular literature, he found that it was 6,500 years ago. And he was the first one to do it. And this is the guy that works for the FBI. So they adopted this. So when they arrest people and they get them for crimes, boom, it goes right to this mutation rate. And he came back, a critic didn't like this, and joined his team, actually, named Holland. And in 1998, they reran the numbers, and they got the exact same thing. Since that time, look at all the studies. Multiple studies have all confirmed the exact same thing. Boom, all of them. Fast mutation rates down the line.
Unbelievable.
And then what's even crazier is they went over to animals. And that's why I was showing you that chicken one earlier. They said, wow, look at this. The chicken rate is exactly the same. It's rapidly fast. All landing on the very most recent common ancestor. So what's bottlenecking all of these animals? We have whales, we have wolves. They haven't tested all life, by the way. They haven't tested everything because doing pedigree mutation rates, you have to isolate.
Well, that was your claim.
So is there only one bottleneck in human DNA?
I'm sorry, what?
Is there only one bottleneck in human DNA?
No, there can be multiple bottlenecks in different animals,
so
like in whale.
Okay, so are there bottlenecks in human DNA prior to 6,500 years ago?
We can't find any, because a bottleneck resets
genetic diversity. Yes, you can, and your claim to the contrary is just false, right?
So where can we find
that? This because of mitochondrial Eve, right?
Mitochondrial Eve based on observed mutation rates. And Tony or Eric, are you familiar with population genetics, Fatuma? He argues that your observed neutral mutation rate equals or approximates the long-term fixation rate or substitution rate. So what do we have? As Matt just showed you, in the mitochondrial genome, looking at the observed rate, looking at pedigrees, okay, Parsons is an incredible study, adopted by the FBI, great methodology. It's fast. There's few DNA differences worldwide. Actually, Eric, he put up in his presentation the Eve consensus sequence paper in the ICC journal. And he said, oh, Rob Carter, he's a hack. He's only publishing in, you know, creatious journals.
The first words of that article were, in order to establish a biblical timeline, because they know for a fact that you cannot get any data that supports a biblical timeline.
Yes, you can. Well,
Well, their data disagrees with all of the other secular data, which is why they went out of their way to create that different model.
The data itself,
and I noticed I got cut off there. I got cut off by Donnie. I was about to explain how mitochondrial Eve dates back to 100,000 to 120,000 years ago. And again, I'm being cut off.
I do want to hear the rest of PhD Tony's sentence.
And genetic Adam dates between 120 and 156,000 years ago. So the claim that the
based on what you're making an assertion.
The claim
on,
that the
one sec.
Jesus, Donnie,
you're making an assertion.
The claim that the peer-reviewed literature backs up that there was one bottleneck at 6,500 years ago, and therefore that's the timeline of the development of humans, is simply untrue. That's not the conclusion that they come to. The existence of a bottleneck for humans at 6,500 years ago indicates is part of the larger genetic history. And you don't get to just cherry pick, here's a result with it where 6,500 appears in it, and it's the only one we're going to listen to. That's not intellectually honest.
Okay, so that was
Two more.
assertion. It's my turn to respond. That was assertion after I'm sitting there waiting patiently for PhD Tony, the guy with the PhD here, to make something other than an assertion. He just says, well, the conclusion or the peer-reviewed literature says the Y chromosome Adam goes back a couple hundred thousand years and Eve goes back a couple hundred thousand. Based on what? We just showed you paper after paper after paper based on pedigree rates that actually show a fast mutation rate somewhere between 0.1 and 0.5 per generation. Rob Carter, okay, a geneticist and marine biologist, he published in the conventional literature. Pull it up, Google it right now. Dr. Rob Carter, mitochondrial DNA diversity. He published mitochondrial DNA data showing that on average, two people are only separated by a few DNA differences, roughly 20 to 30 in the mitochondrial chromosome. Okay, it's a smaller chromosome, roughly 16,500 letters, and max in some African lineages, roughly 120 to 140. And so, based on the observed rate, which according to Fatuma, the observed rate approximates the fixation rate. You know what that means? The observed rate is fast, the fixation rate is fast. Notice this paper from 2022. Estimates of the mutation rate, right from the conventional literature, with a non-phylogenetic approach using pedigree analyses like we've showed, okay, are reported to be approximately what? Tenfold higher. Let me repeat that. Tenfold higher than phylogenetically derived rates. And again, Fatuma here, notice what he says. The rate of fixation of mutations is theoretically constant, and the mutation rate approximates the fixation rate. That's within 6,000 years. How do you explain that from the evolutionary position?
So this is a fallacy, and it's the fallacy that I predicted when I raised my objections to when I raised my objections to James. The fact that I'm not a genetic expert and I'm not au fait with this literature and I can't explain
Well, then let Eric in.
how or why the literature has come to different conclusions than you do. Does not mean that they have not, does it?
Well, then let Eric, if you can't engage the data, I'm surprised you've been doing this for so many years and you haven't even
I
interacted
have not
or looked.
debated. This is my first evolution debate, so maybe check your facts.
I'm talking origins in general. Obviously, you want to focus all on the age of the Earth, but these arguments shouldn't be new to you. And yet, these are the best arguments against common descent and for another model like separate ancestry, which doesn't rely on a young Earth. Okay. So
A
your burden of
model,
proof
you
is not
say.
being met.
A model, you
Tony.
say. And actually, you make a point that I quickly want to touch on. You claim that any doubt at all raised in our model means that therefore creation has to be accepted as a viable alternative. That's not a valid syllogism,
No, the point
right?
is many other. Well, you made a
Sorry,
point.
I
So you
do
just get slap
sometimes.
and run? Slap and run, then I guess. Go
Okay,
ahead,
go.
Tony. Slap and run. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. My point is many other models. Okay. We just debated conspiracy cats. We were in the affirmative, Adam, Eve, and biblical creation. Okay. So we made our case, and it was his job to basically poke holes in our case. Tonight, you're in the affirmative, biological evolution. Okay. My point is. Most of the pieces of evidence that we discuss, whether it's homology, nested hierarchies, even the ordering in the fossil record, is largely agnostic in the sense that many other models could explain the data. And all we have to do, if you're familiar with how a courtroom trial works, is we just got to poke enough holes in the model to raise just enough doubt in the audience to show that no, you haven't met your burden of proof. Y chromosome dissimilarity, mutation rates. Perhaps Eric wants to engage the mutation rate data since Tony, and that's okay. You said that you're not equipped to discuss this point, but this is a discriminating point and it needs to be engaged by you guys.
Except that there's a fundamental fallacy. You are claiming that because you have done this in a debate setting, the audience should accept your argument. And this is fundamentally untrue. The audience should familiarize themselves with the peer-reviewed scientific literature and base their judgment on that, not what a couple of people say in a debate.
Here's the peer-reviewed literature on screen. Matt just went over five or six
cherry-picked and
that's your assertion. It's not
in many instances misinterpreted.
That's your assertion.
You're rejecting the stuff that disagrees with you. That do you reject the claim that mitochondrial Eve has been dated to between 100 and 120,000 years ago? Do you reject that claim?
Yes, because we've already shown based on
So studies, where is your peer-reviewed study establishing that? Because that's in the peer-reviewed literature. So
since your eyes were obviously closed or you're taking a nap, Tony, while we went over all the pedigree-based studies, Matt, feel free to share screen, go through the Parsons
paper.
But
that's an extrapolation from a limited choice of the data.
Oh, no, no, no.
My question was, do you accept that in the peer-reviewed literature, the date for mitochondrial Eve is not what you are giving here? Do you accept that that statement is true or not? If I find a peer-reviewed paper in the literature that says that gives a date for mitochondrial Eve that is older than 6,500 years ago, are you conceding that you are wrong?
No, because Tony, you're underprepared. You're ill-equipped to discuss this topic. Here's my question for you. The date of 200,000 years, let's say, for mitochondrial Eve, what's that based on in the peer-reviewed literature? Go ahead.
I'll let Eric respond.
You're the one making that up,
get a scholarly paper on it, and then I'll let you know.
Don't say that is the consensus, Eric. What is the genetic data?
It absolutely is. That is the consensus.
Based on what evidence?
200,000 years ago, sorry.
Donnie, if I would have known that I need to bring up all the papers that have been published in Nature, that conform, like, you don't pull up sources for just matter of fact things. We don't do that. That's like there's no published scientific paper that proves that that gravity exists. There isn't one. They just go off that working assumption. But anyways, I've had some people that have sent me. So I'm going to respond to a couple things you said, but Matt really hasn't talked at all hardly at all. And I haven't spoken for a while, so I'm hoping to have a little bit of back and forth with Matt here.
This is looking like good cop, bad cop. I'm the bad cop. So Matt,
yeah, something like
jump
that.
In. Have some fun, Matt.
Well, I'm going to respond to you first real quick. So somebody sent me a message. The Parsons 1997 study caught a glimpse of rapid temporary mutations
during the debate
within families. Not long-term evolution. Later corrections adjusted for the transient heteroplasmy get a coalescence time for human mitochondrial DNA of 160,000 years.
What does coalescence mean, Eric? What does coalescence mean? Okay, so you're cheating, basically.
I'm not cheating.
Somebody messaged
I'm giving you,
on you Facebook,
some of the information.
You just read out their response, but you don't even understand the words that you're reading.
That doesn't mean that the information isn't true. Anyways.
James, is that allowed during a debate? Oh, by the way, somebody just sent me a message on how to respond to the creationists that I myself don't know how to respond to.
We haven't discussed
fucking cry
the
about
rules.
It. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, Eric.
Donnie, shut up. You have interrupted everybody at every point, and you've been a total condescending asshole the whole time, too. So just shut up.
See here.
No.
What you just said.
Shut up.
Swear words is you admitting defeat.
I don't care. I don't care about your feelings, and I'm going to interrupt you just like you've been interrupting everybody.
I do want to get back.
You had to get help from someone outside the debate. Hey, there's a clip worthy moment. Go ahead, James.
I want to get back to the topic at hand. Are there any topics that we haven't gotten covered? There's only about 15 minutes left of the open dialogue.
Yeah, well, I have like a few, and I was going to ask them to Matt here, but also, let's see here. Now I got to find it again.
Well, here, but Eric just
literally,
read a point. James,
Donnie,
I want
are you doing?
I want
I'm talking.
I want Jay. You can pause it. Eric just read an argument that someone sent him. I think we have the right, and because I've been doing most of the talking, we can throw it to Matt. I think we have the right to address that, don't we?
Because you're saying you want to respond to what Eric
did.
Said.
You did your pedantry and said, here's the clippable moment. Good for you.
No, but okay. But we want to respond to what you read from whoever helped you. We want to respond to that.
If you do want to cover that, that's fine.
I literally said I'm going to respond to a couple of things, and then I'm going to talk to Matt for a little bit.
So you're allowed to slap and where you can make an argument that we can't respond to, basically?
So here's another thing. Okay. Parsons.
Right, well, hold on one sec. I do want to give, if they do want to respond to what you said, from the person that shared it with you on Facebook, I think it's true that he kind of gave Dr. Dan in terms
wasn't
of, he you could say he gave sizzle. In other words, he rhetorically made fun of you for using messages from other people. He didn't respond to the content itself. So I do want to give him a chance if he does want to respond to the content itself.
Okay, I talk fast, so it's no problem. I can do it. So I'll answer both people at the same time. So Tony, it is true. When you type in Google, how old are humans? You'll get, they lived in Africa about 300,000 years ago. That's true. Why is that? Because this is based on phylogeny. Molecular clocks are calibrated to the fossil record. So they take the fossils, they radiometrically date them, and then they say that must be how old the mutation rate is. So they made their own mutation rate up based on those fossils because they said radiometric dates are king. But then when we tested and we looked like these studies right here did, and we go, what is the observed rate, which are all published and peer-reviewed, by the way. Parsons was just one of the first people to do it. They all found, look, all the way up to 2025, they got fast mutation rates that agree with Parsons' earlier studies. And he tested a massive ethnic group of diverse people to get a substitution rate. And what he did is called a coalescence. So he determined the most diverse person between that living on Earth, by me and some African, are probably 120 differences between us. So they just ran the math on one mutation arising every four generations would put the most recent common ancestor 6,500 years ago. So the studies, as they progressed, they kept getting the same type of results.
That's untrue, right? You understand that that's untrue.
It is?
Yes. So mitochondrial Eve is a common ancestor. A bottleneck is not a common ancestor. These arguments, so the fact that there is a bottleneck, that there is a restriction, that there was a limited population 2,500 years ago is not asserting that there was a common ancestor 6,500 years ago. And I defy you to produce any peer-reviewed literature that says that there was.
Well, the Parsons study, actually all of these peer-reviewed studies talk about the most recent common ancestor living very recently in the biblical timeline. And when they when they went over and they said, well, Australia was isolated.
I'll ask you to validate that claim, sir.
Is Parsons a young Earth creationist, Matt?
No. He works
for
the
FBI.
Okay,
so then the study doesn't support that.
Matt, get aggressive. You want me to jump in and respond? Come on. You know how to respond to this.
Look, 6,500 years ago in his first published study, right there, you can read that is their determining factor, and he's not a young Earth creationist. He found it 20
and
times
And is he
back.
Saying they're the last common ancestor then?
It is the most recent common ancestor for all females alive on Earth, everywhere on Earth, and every island. So how in the world could Australia have a bottleneck and Japan and all these other places hospitable, like living today, but yet all people only descend from a single female 6,500 years ago? There would have
because
to have
they
been a
don't
right.
We know there were humans in North America living at that time, for example, and they didn't all die.
Yet the genetic
no, not
evidence
yet.
Says
and
the opposite.
Parsons literally says if one were to naively apply that high substitution rate across human mitochondrial variation and assume all mutations accumulate at that rate over long time, or in other words, ignore compiling factors, one could derive a much more recent age for the mitochondrial recent common ancestry that they mention. So they're saying, yeah, we found some stuff in here. And if you naively apply the research we found, then you could end up getting a number like that. But Parsons isn't a young Earth creationist. They understand that this is, it's an interesting find, but it doesn't actually support that. They understand what the consensus around this is. And like Donnie was saying, you have evidence that mitochondrial Eve is actually, what, a couple hundred thousand years old? Yeah, like literally in nature right here, mitochondrial DNA and human evolution 200,000 years ago, right there. And this paper cites 58 different studies that are all going to be supportive of that.
And every one will be an evolutionary phylogenetic rate made up by non-observational studies.
That's so now it's a conspiracy theory.
Just let Eric talk for a while. Okay. We're showing you how pedigree-based rates, not just on the Parsons paper, but several other papers, all come to one conclusion that we have a fast observed rate, low diversity in mitochondrial DNA, and an Eve who lived just 6,000 years ago. And then you guys pull up data points and papers that are ignoring the observed rate. Remember, I just showed you the paper from 2022 where they admit that non-phylogenetic methods give us a rate that's 10 times faster than the phylogenetic method. But you guys keep running to the evolution, the assumption-based method, the phylogenetic rate.
I'm sorry, assumption-based. What assumptions? What assumptions?
Matt, they're non-observed.
Assumptions.
So if I say...
No, what are the assumptions? List the assumptions, please.
Okay, I'll list one and then Matt, you can list one. Firstly, in most of the studies, they assume that humans and chimps go back to a common ancestor. So what they do is they ignore the observed rate, Tony. They count up the differences that separate humans and chimpanzees, and then they trace back to get a much slower rate because they're assuming common ancestry rather than taking the observed rate and saying, hey, look at this. The observed rate is fast, 0.1 to 0.5 per generation. Overall diversity in the mitochondrial chromosome is low. So, wow, that's only a few thousand years.
Can we clarify your model here? Your model is that by 7 million years ago, God had created a species that was intermediate between humans and the other great apes. And at various stages in the past 7 million years, God created other intermediate species like Ardipithecus ramidus, Homopithecus, et cetera, to make it look like they diverge. And then at 300,000 years ago, God created humans. That's your model of what actually happened, is it?
No, not even close.
Okay, then how is that not what the observed data tells us occurred, that there were seven million years ago potential common ancestors intermediate between humans and the rest of the great apes, and that there was a steady progression of intermediate species from that point forward? Is that not what the fossil record shows? If you're claiming that it isn't through descent, then you're claiming that God created these intermediate species, let the other ones go extinct or whatever happened, that God has been continually creating these new species through the time. And I don't even care if you sort of compress it all down to whatever ridiculously short interval you want.
Your claim is that
these species were created and then killed off by God, but we shouldn't believe this evidence.
Okay, I want equal time to respond. There's a lot there. Okay, a few points in our last couple minutes. Again, you're dodging very hard the genetic data that acts as discriminatory evidence against your position. You guys have the burden of proof. Secondly, you're making a lot of assertions based on so-called transitional fossils in the rock record, like the Australopithecines or Paranthropus or Homo habilis or whoever, you name it. I've got some slides here up on the screen, James, my brother. And so many, even in your own camp, okay, you'll notice this. And there are major fossil record discontinuities that I would love to challenge you guys on in a second. But notice this, when it comes to Lucy's gait or the postcranial material that apparently provides us evidence for Lucy walking upright in an intermediate fashion. Even paleoanthropologists Conroy and Ponser point out that Lucy's lumbar and sacral vertebra were extraordinarily small, not suited for the heavy load bearing required for fully upright posture. That means she wasn't a habitual walker like us, more of a part-time biped, still adapted for climbing. In other words, close enough to resemble human locomotion superficially, but anatomically still a different kind altogether. In terms of
100% consistent with human evolution.
No, because what we're showing we're showing variation that Lucy was Eric, we're showing that Lucy and the other Australopithecines was both different to extant apes like chimps and modern humans. But
You just have to say, yeah, God made Australopithecus.
No, because there. What we look at, just like in genetics, we look at what's called genetic level discontinuities, like these massive differences that we see in Y chromosomes. Then we look at the fossil record and we look to fossil discontinuities and notice this one. We'll see how you guys can engage this before we move into closings. The only known hyoid bone, which is important for speech, of course, as we all know, from Australopithecus afarensis, the same species as Lucy, is chimp-like. Not human-like. It has the bola and air sac features of apes.
Wow, so a 5-million-year-old hominin is slightly more closer to a more basal ape like a chimpanzee than a human?
In a major trait.
We
split a major trait. And it turns out Neanderthals
says you,
actually have
we don't
the
know
same
if they had speech at all. Nobody,
okay,
no evolutionary biologist said, oh yeah, Lucy's the missing link and she could talk. Nobody ever said that.
So where's the hyoid bone?
This doesn't preclude evolution in any way. It's 100% consistent with evolution.
Where's the transitional?
None of this is even a
Lucy transition. Has some traits that are a little bit more chimp-like than modern human-like. Great.
Tony.
Exactly what the
Gentlemen,
evolutionary biologist would
jump
say.
In. I do want to jump in just to give Donnie a chance to respond.
He's talked more than anybody by far.
Yeah, but you guys don't stick to one point at a time.
But both you and PhD Tony had raised an objection. So I do want to, before you guys go forward, I do want to give Donnie a chance to respond.
I was in the middle of my sentence, and then he started talking while I was talking.
Eric,
okay.
Let me just respond.
Nonetheless, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, James. Okay, guys, we're excited. This is a debate. Like, there's no point in crying here. Let's have some fun. You guys have the burden of proof. I understand it's stressful. And the tension is high because you guys are failing to meet your burden of proof. And that's okay. We'll just leave it up to
the
audience.
That's the point you wanted to make. Are you done? Is it my turn now?
So my question to Tony, where's the transitional series from a creature like an Australopithecine, take Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, with a hyoid bone that is important for speech, that is closer to chimps, okay, to a so-called transitional fossil or form in the human hominin line, that now has a human-like hyoid bone built for speech? How do you answer this discontinuity? Go ahead.
So because the fossil record is stochastic, right? Fossils only form under very specific conditions, and they're not that common. You asked me a question. You now get to be quiet.
And you answered. You said you don't have it. Thank
no,
you.
That's... That's not the I'll determine when I finished answering. Thank you for your offer. This gets back to your point earlier about the unreliability or the incompleteness of the fossil record. We don't, and this is again a complete mischaracterization of science, that we need absolute certainty, that we need ironclad evidence of every stage in a process. No, we understand that all of our observations and all of our inferences, in fact, everything we think we know, comes with uncertainty estimates. And accepting that there are uncertainty estimates is not a license for you to plow in and say, therefore, the entire body of human scientific knowledge is somehow invalid. That's not how anything works in science.
So and all of that to say, he doesn't have the evidence. We're over 50 minutes. I'm pretty happy. These guys did not meet.
What Donnie's doing here, everybody, is Donnie knows that we have the missing links. So now what Donnie's doing is
looking. Where's the missing link?
Why are you interrupting me?
I do want to hear from Planet Peterson.
Tony responded. Then what, Eric? You respond right after? He's on your team.
I do want to. It sounded, to be fair, though, Donnie, it sounded like, I think Eric, as I interpreted it as well, thought that you were done with your point. So Eric wanted to jump in.
Yeah, no kidding.
I do want to give Eric.
So what Donnie's doing is Donnie knows the missing links are found. So what Donnie's doing is looking for missing links within the missing links. Oh, but if you don't know about the hyoid bone, then that proves something. It doesn't. Yeah. This is exactly the tactic that he used with the Y chromosome. Ignore the entire genome. What about the Y chromosome is less than 2% of the genome. The whole genome is incontrovertibly supporting evidence of human chimp common ancestry. But what if I take a look at 2% of it and look at a fraction of the 2% of it that I don't like? Lucy is incontrovertibly a missing link between more basal and not quite fully bipedal primates and humans. And Donnie knows that. So what if I point to one of its 206 bones, the hyoid? This would be like if Tony and I said, oh, well, you guys have to produce every single Bible that was ever written from the time when Jesus was alive to today. And if you don't have a continuation of every single scripture and manuscript and Bible from then to today, then the creation account is wrong because you don't even have all of the data. It's completely dishonest. So are we out of time? Because 30 minutes ago, I said I wanted to talk to Matt things, and then it got derailed.
Since Eric gets to have the first closing, I'll have the quick final word. Because
that wasn't my closing, and no, I asked James a question.
Listen, I know
so
you're
shut
excited,
up.
But listen, okay, Eric?
I asked James a question, so I'm not going to let you do this.
I do. Okay, so we can go a few more minutes for this topic that you want to discuss, Eric, because it is true that I think you have probably, we've heard from you a bit less. So I do want to give you a chance. Donnie, it sounds like you had something you wanted to say. What was it, Donnie, that you had on your mind?
Well, I'm very happy with how this debate turned out. Eric misrepresented me a couple times. We do have closing statements. I'll make this really, Eric, calm down. I know you're excited. Okay. You believe you're related to a banana plant. I know that's an exciting
We share
belief.
Genes with them, so I know that we are. That's what it means to be related to something genes with it. And even you know it.
So do you believe that you and a banana plant go back to a common ancestor?
We share genes. That's what it means to be related to something. That's
and
the
you're gonna
only
extrapolate
viable
that
explanation
to the banana
for the data.
Plant? Okay.
I hate to do this.
I want to finish my point. Eric, I know you're excited. Let me just finish my point. He misrepresented me. I didn't only focus on the Y chromosome. I described that even in similar sequences between humans and chimpanzees, there's massive differences in how those genes are regulated, how they're expressed, differences in epigenetics. And the hyoid bone, it's a complete dodge. The 5 Ds of evolution is dodgeball. Dodge, duck, dip, dive, and dodge. Completely dodge answering where that transitional series is. The hyoid bone is very important. We as humans actually can speak. And we can express thoughts and ideas, okay? And it turns out Neanderthals had a hyoid bone just like us, consistent with the separate ancestry model. But these guys, for 3 minutes, just ramble on, and it's all summed up in what? They don't have the evidence. Well, they didn't meet their burden of proof, and that's all I got to say.
I do want to give Eric a chance, because he had said there was something he just wanted to talk about for about 30 minutes. Before we go to the closings, Eric, what was it that you did want to discuss?
I just wanted to ask some questions to Matt because Matt's spoken the least and, you know, he had like his presentation, but it's mostly been just Donnie, Tony, and I.
I figured I talked so fast in my opening, I didn't need to talk anymore. No.
We got like 5 minutes, James. Is that?
Let's stick with that.
Okay, so you don't have to pull it up because I have it pulled up on the other screen here, Matt, but you have this list of things, creation versus evolution, and it's just the most incredible thing I've ever seen. You have genetic similarity with a check mark for creation versus no genetic similarity for evolution. Who told you that evolution predicted that there would be no genetic similarities? Because that's the opposite of what's true.
That was actually predicted by Ernest Mayr in 1963. He predicted based on mutation scrambling, there would be no genetic similarity between you and some distantly related species like an alligator.
That's one guy, right?
That's and I don't know what you even mean by that. So pro tip, don't use quotes from the 1960s. Try to have modern science on your hand. Geneticists do not agree that Ernest Mayr was correct in that assessment. But that's also not what your slideshow says. Your slideshow says genetic similarity versus no genetic similarity. So I like to leave out the details of what you meant there. I don't understand the tactic there. So by genetic similarity versus no genetic similarity, you specifically meant what exactly that Ernst Mayr
There are
said?
Ernest Mayr said homologous genes will not be shared. They're like a Hox gene, a body layout plan that made you and it made a frog should not exist in other species. Evolution will invent its own. So we won't have genetic similarity for that at all.
So
But we
Ernst
did.
Mayr was wrong, and
Yeah, but
that was 70 years ago, and we just know so much more today. I just like the idea that evolution predicted this and it was wrong. No, Ernst Mayr said this one thing.
Yeah, but that's the important part about a prediction. It has to come first, and they found the evidence a little bit later. That's the cool part about predictions. Just like the creationists made the prediction first.
Sure. So, for
Warren, but
example, do we share genes with all life on this planet?
yes.
Okay, is that consistent with evolution?
No, it's a creationist prediction, 1975.
No, it's an evolutionary prediction. Darwin specifically, he had an incorrect model of gemmules or whatever, but like all evolutionists, all biologists think that life comes about through reproduction, right?
Yes.
And when you re the molecular unit for heredity is the gene, right?
Yep.
So evolution absolutely predicts that there would be genetic similarities between organisms.
Yes, but they didn't make the actual prediction because like Darwin didn't even know what DNA was or genes. But the creationists, when they figured that out that there was genes, they said, aha,
Post hoc. That's
I bet you if
post
there was a
hoc what you
creator.
just did there. Yeah.
Eric, just
But
provide the citation. Where was the prediction made for genetic level homology and nested hierarchies? Go ahead, we'll wait.
Like literally Darwin made the prediction, but he didn't know what that molecule, what form that molecule took. Nobody did. We didn't know that it was DNA until like the 1920s
What's his
ish or
quote? How did he
something like
make it?
that.
Be specific. What was his prediction? How did he say it?
So Darwin's theory, I don't have the exact quote from his book, but he says, this is funny because I was supposed to be talking to Matt, right? He says that there's variation within species, and that variation is heritable, and that species compete and all this other stuff. So embedded within the logic of how he lays out, there are like the, I don't know what you'd call, not presuppositions or whatever, but these just basic observed facts where, well, the variation is heritable was, I guess, a scientific assumption or whatever. But that is the prediction. We didn't know what form the heritability would take in like the scope of molecular biology or whatever, but it was absolutely made. So,
But didn't you
anyways,
just
us
say
sharing
earlier? But
genes with life on the planet is a prediction of bio or of evolution, and it absolutely came true.
you got mad that I went to a guy in the 1940s that was a too early of a prediction that he got it wrong. But yet you went to Darwin, who's way before him.
Darwin got it right.
Oh, but the other because the other guy got it wrong, it doesn't count. Okay.
It doesn't disprove anything.
But that's what the gold standard of science
But
is accurate
I have
testable
a
predictions.
question on I have a question on this. So there's a creationist talking a point about code, and the DNA is like code, and that it makes sense that God would use the same code over and over again. But there are multiple ways to code a sorting algorithm, for instance. There are multiple different algorithms for doing that, right?
Yes.
So the fact that there exist different solutions that people can use, why is God so limited in his repertoire? Surely this isn't the conclusive evidence that you, again, this is what Eric was saying before. This is a post hoc. We see genetic similarities, therefore God must be using the same code all the time. But there's no necessity to use the same code. There's no ne why, what, wh and the claim that code is functional, what functional similarity do we and banana plants have that required God to use the same genetic code?
Well,
We
we live on the
live
same.
I'll give you a chance, Don, to respond, and then we do have to go into the closings, though. So
Okay.
I'll give you maybe 2 or 3 minutes. I'll give you 2 minutes, Don, to respond.
Thank you, brother. Excellent debate. So I think Eric and Tony are missing the bigger picture here. What Matt was saying, and Matt could possibly reiterate in the concluding statement, is many evolutionists said, once we discovered DNA and genetics, Darwin knew nothing about DNA, knew nothing about genetics. They said, okay, we should not expect to find such strong hierarchical signatures or strong homologous signatures in DNA, because according to the neutral model of evolution, you have mutations accumulating every single generation, and they accumulate and act ultimately as a hidden reservoir of genetic change and adaptive evolution. So those mutations that accumulate over time should actually what? Scramble those genetic hierarchies, scramble those homologous signatures. The fact that we have such strong patterns in the biological world points better to a common design perspective than the evolutionary model. Okay. To PhD Tony's question, we do. We find a lot of variation in the biological world. God has designed interesting mosaics like the synapses, like platypus, like Archaeopteryx. Just like human engineers design in hierarchical patterns and homologous patterns, this is good design, purpose-driven mosaics like we see in the design world. The military has designed the military amphibious assault vehicle. This is all good design. It's an alternative explanation, which means it's not differentiating. It's not discriminatory, which is what Tony and Eric need to provide tonight. And I believe that they failed to do so.
We're going to jump into the queue, the closing statements. So we started with Eric and PhD Tony. We'll end with, or I should say, we'll go in the same order with Eric and PhD Tony. You have 5 minutes for your closing, and then we'll go to the closing with Raw Matt and Standing for Truth. And then the Q&A, folks, if you have questions, feel free to submit them in the live chat as we are going to rocket through those questions. With that, gentlemen, the floor is all yours.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't prepare a closing. I don't know. I kind of stopped taking notes, but I'll just point out something that like got brought up by the debate. I bookmarked it in the first book I wrote. It's about the mitochondrial Eve thing once again. So the Institution of Creation Research, they have this paper on their website, and they have a quote in here. Regardless of the cause, evolutionists are more concerned about the effect of a faster mutation rate. For example, researchers have calculated that mitochondrial Eve, the woman whose mitochondrial DNA was ancestral to that, in all living people, lived 100,000 to 200,000 years ago in Africa. Using the new clock, mitochondrial Eve would have lived a mere 6,000 years ago. So that's from a specific study. The creationists are citing the study that says, and I don't think it's the exact same one, the Parsons or whatever paper it was that the two guys brought up before, but they're quoting this paper on their website as if to say, see, even the scientists are now admitting that the real number you get is to 6,000 years old, except they selectively left off the very next sentence from that study they quoted, which is, quote, nobody thinks that's the case, unquote. What the author was doing was talking about how bad methodology will yield inaccurate results in there. And that's another thing from, again, I forgot the name of the, like, Parsons or whatever. But I pointed this out earlier. Parsons literally points out the same thing. Parsons is not a young earth creationist. If you guys think that he's a junk scientist because despite doing the data and he's still not a young earth creationist, and because he's, I don't know, whatever, he's against God or something like that, well, then why would you bring up his study if apparently he's not even a competent scientist? Because if he wasn't converted by the science, then the science isn't on your side, and that guy's not on your side either. And the people from the study, they literally point out, yeah, this is a surprising result, but there are other variables that you have to take into account when you do these kinds of studies. So I'll just have to leave it at that.
My refutation, I'll go back again, the robustness of various geochronological data sets, radiometric dating of various forms, uranium, cerium, potassium, argon, rubidium, strontium, hafnium, neodymium, lutetium, hafnium, These confirm one another. They are also consistent with cosmogenic isotope dating, and they are consistent with amino acid racemization dates. All of these techniques confirm that Matt's claim of a young Earth is absolutely fallacious. His claims are inconsistent with ice core data, with ocean floor sediments. Want to move on quickly from that. What has happened here is that there has been a cherry picking of quotes from scientific papers, as though the conclusions of the papers themselves agree with my interlocutors. As I pointed out in my original statement, in the very early stages of my presentation, that is not a valid way to sample science. You don't get to quote a little bit of the paper and then say, well, that supports us, if the conclusion of the paper was that you're dead wrong. My interlocutors have routinely misrepresented scientific consensus, and when presented with it, have become quite demanding that we be as expert as the people who wrote the papers, which is an unreasonable demand. Further, the idea that any sort of uncertainty or any sort of gap in the fossil record is somehow an invitation to bulldoze in with a therefore you haven't substantiated dissent is not that's not how syllogisms work, and it's not how science works. I will also finish with the fact that creationism is just a completely unscientific and unfalsifiable hypothesis. It can be post hoc adapted to fit with any new data set. And it has been, and we've seen it on display here many, many times. The very fact that they can't even discriminate between the timescales that they want this to occur on is evidence of just how unscientific it is. If it were a valid scientific theory,
And
they would have an established
here
timeline.
we're at time. We'll kick it over to Ramat and Stanley for Druids for their final 5 minutes.
Thank you very much, James. I'll share screen here. Is it showing, James?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you, brother. All right, fun debate. Clearly, the evolutionists did not meet their burden of proof. Tony came to the wrong debate. Guess he didn't get the memo. He's basically debating the question, who's the strongest superhero in DC Comics? And you got Tony here bringing up Iron Man and Spider-Man and Thor. It's like, Tony, come on, man. Those are Marvel superheroes. DC Comics. That would be Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. So he's tapped out. They have not addressed the discriminatory evidence. Clearly, they're both not equipped for this debate. Perhaps we can get some of the big dogs, Aaron Ra, Professor Dave. Gutsy Gibbon, round 10. Let's do it. You know, they didn't even bring up the actual best evidence for evolution. I was hoping for more of a challenge. Endogenous retroviruses, shared endogenous retroviral-like sequences in the DNA of biological organisms. We now understand that ERVs are involved in embryological development, immune defense, tumor suppression. And Tony says, oh, creationists don't make any falsifiable predictions. We predict, based on design diversity, I talked about this throughout the debate, that if design diversity is true, if the separate ancestry model is true, then we would predict that the majority of the genomes of living organisms, focusing on humans, let's say, are functional. And now we know the best so-called evidence, which is probably why they didn't bring them up, pseudogenes, Alu sequences, endogenous retroviruses, the other various classes of retrotransposons, are necessary to sustain healthy life processes in the cell. We have powerful evidence for genome-wide functionality, confirmed prediction of biblical creationism, and these guys are dodging hard. And Eric says he's completely tapped out. It's ridiculous to say that I've got notes from what he said in his opening, that for organisms to not share relationship is that is if they didn't share genes with each other. That'd be like saying the only way a GM vehicle, whether a Chevy Cruze, Chevy Impala, Chevy Malibu could belong to GM as the manufacturer is if they had no similarities with each other. Whoever taught Eric these arguments, he needs to go get his money back. They lied to him. And if PhD Tony wants to have the biblical creation debate, Well, let's do it. We just did that with conspiracy cats. We were in the affirmative. Yeah, PhD Tony's complaining. Oh, they bring up these gaps, these discontinuities. That's the point of you being in the burden of proof. Okay, you have to show why biological evolution is best supported by the evidence, and you failed. You failed miserably. We brought forth discriminating points that you guys had no answer to, completely dodged the hyoid bone, major discontinuity, downplayed it like it's insignificant. I mean, thank God I'm not an evolutionist who believes they're related to banana plants. If we really wanted to get into, like he did, dating methods and ice cores and so on and so forth, sure. We could talk about the helium and zircon crystals that should not be there if zircon crystals really are billions of years old. We could talk about C14 in diamond. If every single atom in the universe were made of radiocarbon, it should have all decayed away in easily 500,000 years. Yet we find radiocarbon in just about everything, diamonds, coal. So if he wants to have a debate on the age of the earth on trial, let's do it. Okay. But tonight it's biological evolution on trial. He did not prep. That was clear. And it's been fun. Matt, go ahead, brother. You got about 3 minutes.
All right.
Here I'm going to run to the restroom as you do that.
Okay. So the reason I had brought up the Neanderthal population size is because, remember, Adam and Eve was a single generation and they exploded in population size. So inbreeding wouldn't have been a problem because expansion, right? So Neanderthal, unfortunately, though, they lived for 400,000 years in very small tribes. So therefore, they would have had an inbreeding problem. That was the difference. And after the global flood bottleneck, again, expansion. Neanderthals, group of people, after the flood, stayed in small populations. It would have made them go extinct in about 1,000 years. So that's why I brought that up. And I try to use peer-reviewed studies for everybody so that they don't have to read creationist literature. That was what the mutation rate studies were as well. Punctuated equilibrium was brought up because it's a falsification of evolution. It's not a proof of young Earth creation, of course, but since the debate was to prove evolution is wrong, that's why I brought it up. Also, if you're a programmer and you're writing a code to create something, you would just make a new code to create something else. You wouldn't create an entirely new program to write a code, though. So that's why it was a young Earth creationist prediction in the first place, to base all life having the same code in it. Let's see. Oh, the peer review challenge. I would say that I feel free to make any study, make it accurate. Matter of fact, take your PhD, write a study, make sure it's 100% accurate, and submit it as though it's a young Earth creationist thing, and it'll watch it get rejected. Watch it just get completely removed. Now, that would be your challenge, because then what does that show you? It shows you that they're biased. They don't care about it. So when we try to submit to something and you get rejected, what are we supposed to do? We can't say, come and look at it. We can't say there's young Earth creation in the study, because it will immediately, PLOS Biology immediately rejected me. They said, oh, we're not interested in that type of material. And because science today is locked into paradigms, they actually admit that these avenues blocked when you come in with new things. Matter of fact, it is said that Einstein actually would have never passed peer review. So that's interesting. So when you go back to the history of it, Charles Lyell had a secret agenda, and it was to free the sciences of Moses. He was influenced by John Lee's Lamarck, who said that nature by its own means can successively make new species of animals, beginning from simple and ending in complex. And Lyell said, I devoured Lamarck. His theories delighted me. His arguments, if pushed as far as it must go, would prove that man came from the orangutan. Charles Darwin took his book with him on the voyage, and he was highly influenced by this. And that's where this all stems from. That's that mindset that he took from other people influenced his mindset for evolution. And it was literally made up by somebody with an agenda. He hated the Bible. So that's one thing I really wanted to get out there. The goal of evolution, of course, is to explain the diversity of life. And mutation rates.
That is your time. So okay, we're going to jump into the Q&A. I want to say, folks, thank you very much for your questions. We have a lot of them here, so we're going to move fast. Quick couple of plugs. Look at Planet Peterson right now. Can you look at him, folks? You're watching live right now. Look at his charming, dapper goatee beard. You can see it in person. That goatee beard is going to be at DebateCon 6. You don't want to miss it. He'll be taking on. It's going to be these big, beautiful debates. If you want to see him not only debate, but more importantly, get to meet your favorite content creators, come out to Nashville, November 15th and 16th. The link is in the description box. I'm going to pin it at the top of the chat. DebateCon 6, grab your tickets now. Come out and see Planet Peterson and many others. And also, just loading these up. Folks, if you have a Prime membership with Amazon, you get a free Twitch subscription. You can use it toward any content creator you want on Twitch. I'm going to put the Modern Day Debate channel for our Twitch channel link in the description box and the live chat. If you want to help support us, you can use your free Prime sub on Modern Day Debate's Twitch. We do appreciate that support as well. Here we go. We got a lot of questions, so we're going to move fast. I want to say, folks, thanks for your questions. We're going to look for more substantive questions. So if you're just calling someone like fat retard, we're probably going to skip that. So this one comes in from Kevin Blackwell, says, can anyone provide the number of generations it takes to fixate a single mutation across any species? Where was this observed and what was the species?
Well, I can do humans. If humans count, then yes, we can go to these studies and we see that the fixation rate for Parsons, again, he found that it was a fixation rate in most of the AFDL families at one substitution every 17 generations, and the average being one out of every 33, with a maximum of the slowest mutation rate for some reason was Amish people, which was very weird, but they have a very slow mutation rate at one out of every 80. So that was humans. Animals will have different because their population size, their generation time, and there's a lot of factors. So
you didn't answer the question at all.
Wait,
how long does it take? And when has it been?
How long
observed?
Does it take? Sorry, one substitution will fixate every 17 generations with an average of one out of every 30 to 33 in humans.
Is that specific enough for you, Eric?
When has that been observed?
That was in the Parsons paper as well. That's been done in others as well. But I just went directly to the Parsons paper because his was the largest study ever done.
If you're prepared for the debate, Eric, you would have known that.
Docky. If I would have known of every paper feisty that's ever been written.
Does feisty Donnie. Docky Bible Club, thanks for your super sticker. And Kevin Blackwell says, if humans and chimps are 99% similar, that would mean that there is a 30 million fixation difference between them since our genome is about 3 billion.
Big number, scary, therefore false. This is what flat earthers do too.
Let me know if, would you, okay. This one coming in from Marilyn says, creation and evolution. Does Marilyn hang out at your channel, Standing for Truth?
Possibly, kind of rings a bell.
I'd have to says, look creation and evolution are psyops. Okay, you're both wrong, all of you. We are the image of God. We always were and always will be. I don't know what that means. Carl Slagan says, the man with the full Rikers first point is spot on. Who has the full Rikers and what does
full
that
Riker,
mean?
What's that?
I don't know what that means.
The question itself is flawed and suggests that the field of evolutionary biology is a monolith. Okay, so I think they're talking about Donnie, but they didn't mention what question it was that refers to evolutionary biology as a monolith.
If it's referring to my points on burden of proof, what this debate is and what it isn't about, whether it's a monolith or not, there are variations within evolutionist understanding. You can see that when you dig into the technical literature. But the point is, there could be many other models, not just the creation model that we hold to, that equally explains the evidence. And that's why it was so important throughout the debate that Tony and Eric focus on the discriminatory evidence, not pieces of evidence that many other models, including the creation model, can explain.
You got it. This one coming in from, do appreciate it, Dr. Dino. Not that Dr.
Sounds
Dino.
Sounds familiar.
They say it's not Kendo, but paleontologist here. Archaeopteryx isn't a problem for bird evolution, nor are any other feathered dinosaurs. Peterson, are you having an after show?
No.
You got it, Doctor. By the way, though, all of our guests are linked in the description box. So, folks, do check out our guests. We do appreciate them.
Is that an assertion for us or no?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember anybody saying Archaeopteryx is a problem.
Okay, so yes, they were saying, they're challenging you, Donnie. They were saying Archaeopteryx is not a problem for bird evolution, nor are any other feathered dinosaurs, you soy boy.
I have a feeling you added that part, James.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as I laid out in my opening statement, I'm not really concerned with taking every single so-called transitional fossil like Archaeopteryx. The synapsids are a great one. Eric, appreciate you bringing that up. Tiktaalik. These are interesting mosaics. They blend features of different creatures. But when we compare that to the design world, we see the exact same thing. We see human engineers design the military amphibious assault vehicle, which blends features from land tanks and ships in the sea, crossover SUVs. So my main argument was Archaeopteryx is an interesting bird. So mosaic, it's agnostic.
You got it. This one coming in from, do appreciate it. Kevin Blackwell says, first junk DNA proved evolution. Now junk DNA doesn't exist. Are these experts the people peer reviewing papers? This seems to be self-fulfilling.
Nobody ever said
I'd
that.
I'd like to address that, if I may. So if junk DNA doesn't exist, what exactly is it in the DNA that humans and bananas share that is functional, and what function does it have?
Matt, you want to respond to that?
Well, ERVs were predicted to have no function whatsoever.
That isn't my question. I asked you a question.
Matt, he's asking what in the genetics of banana plants and humans require them to have the same genes functionally?
Again, it goes back to the same designer. So nucleotide sequences having functions would base that on like how would the organism grow? How would it bind to things? How would it uptake water?
What are the common functions that humans and bananas have that require them to share 50% of their DNA?
Well, Tony, are you familiar with housekeeping genes?
I am familiar with housekeeping genes, yes. And you're arguing that that's 50% of the genome.
No, but these conserved genes are essential. They're responsible for essential biological functions that all life, including banana plants and humans, need to survive, such as replicating DNA, regulating cell cycles, existing in the same environment,
and
basic cellular functions.
And that takes up 50% of our DNA.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think you have a very low view of just how sophisticated the genome is, Tony. But you did say you're not a geneticist.
Complexity is an argument against design. So you can, yes, it is.
No.
Design is we can tell a design by its elegance and its efficiency, and the fact that life is complex and messy argues against a design and not in favor of one.
Well, if by messy you mean it's full of junk, evolutionary leftovers, that's been completely overturned. The vast majority of the human genome is active, biochemically active.
There's a difference between the vast majority and all, isn't there?
Tony,
we have genes that don't even work anymore.
Tony,
why did God give us the gene for making vitamin C, but then made it so it doesn't actually work in us? There's no account for that.
Eric, the beginnings of your sentences are starting in the middle of mine in the Q&A. Gulo pseudogene, I've done debates on that. Okay, yeah, we have true mutations due to what's called mutational hotspots. But that doesn't change the fact that the majority of the genome is functional, which actually makes those mutations, those neutral mutations, it makes them nearly neutral, slightly deleterious, and very damaging to your theory.
This might be...
No.
Yeah,
that's just an assertion.
You won, Tony. You won.
Oh, at all.
Actually, you saying no is an assertion.
Well, they're both assertions.
I've actually shown you paper after paper ENCODE project showing how functional the genome is. James, go ahead.
I want to give the last word to PhD Tony because I think the question was directed at him. Yep.
Okay. Note the weasel words that Donnie will not dwell on, which is the vast majority. And the questioner was saying that the entirety of the genome is functional, that there is no such thing as junk DNA. Donnie just debunked that. So the question is, the questioner is not correct that all of our genetic code has function.
This one coming in from Basil Problem says, Bonnie, I like your slides. Who has the bigger slide deck, you or Craig Hovind? I don't know if they're drunk or just trolling.
Maybe a
Carl
little of
Slagan
both.
says it appears that Matt's too busy orbiting the Jedi Templar. Nice. This one from Taking Back Eden, Flat Earth.
No,
PP and
geez.
Tony, are you a rock, fish, ape, or all three?
Ooh.
Well, certainly
Phylogeny.
We're in the
certainly not
log
a
fin fish
rock.
clade, so sure go
There's,
with that.
yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that fish is biologically meaningful, is it?
Not,
This,
no, it's I can't
according to
remember. I can't.
phylogeny, though, Tony, are you a fish? According to phylogeny.
I don't accept that the term fish has biological meaning. I am descended from, I am part of a clade of ocean-dwelling organisms that were at one point ocean-dwelling organisms. Fine, I accept that. But I fail to see why this is such a problem. Even if I accept, surely that it seems to me, and I could be wrong, that the problem for Christians is that if there's no boundary between humans and animals, then there's no specialness to humans. There's no support for the claim humans have souls. But that's always seemed to be God's problem, not humans' problem. God is the person who has to determine where souls begin and where they aren't. That's not science's problem. And I don't accept that souls exist, just to be explicit. But I just reject the entire characterization. Yes, I'm descended from microbes. I'm descended from ocean-dwelling organisms. Have no problem with it.
You got it. This coming from Witsit Gets It, PhD Tony's old pal, says, Planet Peterson, you repeatedly attempted to hand wave dismiss evidence solely because it was presented by a creationist. We get you're terrified of genetics, but you
Never did
do
that.
realize that is a genetic fallacy, correct?
I mean, I literally never did that. It kind of would be a genetic fallacy if that had been the case, but no, I literally never did that.
Wow. Snorkel the World says, question for Tony. You said if creation were correct, we would expect sudden emergence of life forms without precursors. So, Cambrian explosion proves creation?
No, because there were precursors.
Yeah, the Ediacaran. And the
Yeah,
Cambrian
but
explosion is a 40 million year period. It's not sudden at all.
James,
You
if I
got it.
could briefly, just saying that they're precursors, but then we actually look at the Cambrian explosion where we've got the sudden massive appearance of all these major phyla, jellyfish, coral, the trilobite, and its highly sophisticated eye. These are phylum level differences. So I'd like to see the series. They say precursors. Show me the series of these primitive organisms up to a trilobite, up to a jellyfish. I think they misunderstand the Cambrian explosion challenge. Go ahead. Yeah, just show me those.
So we might not, especially because the Cambrian was such an incredibly long time ago, we might not find specifically the transitions from like more complex jelly or from simple jellyfish to more complex jellyfish, right? But PhD Tony actually laid this out in his opening. The fossil record clearly goes from simple organisms to more complex organisms. So if we don't have, like, if you're just going to demand a hyper specific high resolution transition in a specific phylum for a specific group or whatever, and then like try to claim victory on that, then whatever. But the other thing with this is the way people just completely bastardize what the fossil record is. When you say the only thing that happens in the fossil record is the sudden appearance of, you can't fossilize the tran like you can find transitional fossils, but you can't fossilize the transitional process itself. So like just to give a quick analogy, when we do archaeological excavations, we don't find the first cornerstone that was ever laid in Rome. All we'd find are complete buildings of Rome from the ancient period. So therefore, Rome was built in a day. No, that's completely stupid to think that and the structures actually are pretty similar, that because we only find mostly complete or partial, whatever, pieces of buildings when we excavate Rome, that means that the buildings weren't gradually built. They were built all at once or something.
That's a long way to say that you don't have the precursor. So I appreciate it. The Cambrian explosion remains a challenge.
Where's the very first Bible? You don't have it. Therefore, the Bible's not, it's not, the Bible was written 100 years ago. There, that's my claim. And because you don't have the very first Bible, therefore it's false. Dipshit
dating
argument.
Back thousands of years ago. Eric,
yes, but it's an exact analogy.
Let's just move on. The audience can see the storytelling. Go ahead.
This one from Child of Yahweh MD says, PhD Tony, genetics are fundamental to evolution. How is pro-evolution not post hoc?
I don't think I understand the question. So our understanding of the process by which evolution occurs has adjusted in response to new data, but this does not mean that evolution has not made successful predictions that were later confirmed. This is very different from the process that I see of creationists, where they claim victory for stuff that seems like post hoc rationalization to me. But obviously there's a difference of perception here.
You got it. This one coming in from Run Boston Bear says, Tony, why do you groundlessly appeal to consensus and claim to know papers are wrong before even reading them? You repeatedly did the same thing when Whitsitt was dunking on you the other day.
Well, it's great to have fans. That's all I can say. No, I didn't claim that papers were wrong before I had read them. I never said that at any point. The question is whether or not a paper can be valid if it hasn't been through peer review and hasn't been validated in the peer-reviewed literature. And cherry-picking slices of papers and presenting the results out of context and saying, therefore, these arguments support a completely different interpretation, that claim is falsified by the very existence of the peer review and the validation process. You cannot interpret their data to support an argument that is contrary to the conclusion that they came to. Otherwise, the article would never have made it past peer review and would never have been validated.
You got it. Thank you very much. This question coming in from Chaldiva. We got that one. Kevin says, the entire human genome shows evolution. Do you honestly think you can get 42 million mutations fixated across an entire species in 13 million years?
What, and 6,500 is more plausible?
Assume the majority of DNA differences are due to mutations, Tony. There's another one of your assumptions, my friend.
This one coming.
Do you assume magic exists?
Yes.
No, because what we put forth as
What
we put forth as a model makes testable predictions. You believe nothing came into existence and created time matter. Oh, you do.
What did God create the universe out of?
Single-celled like ancestors evolved from non-living chemicals. You're related to a banana plant. That's the real
magic. I share genes with bananas and so do you. So I know that I'm related to them because that's what it means. What did God create the universe out of?
Fallacy, Eric. And what did God create the universe out of? Because that's the best you got. No ERVs.
What did God create the universe out of?
He created it out of nothing, ex nihilo, outside of time, matter.
So the thing that you said, I'm an idiot for believing, is what you believe in. Congratulations.
So, but how can somebody be outside of time and then experience a series of events? God noticed that there was no universe, decided to make a universe, and then made a universe. That is a sequence of events that requires time to exist. Somebody who is outside of time cannot do that, right? Without time existing, he cannot make a decision and he cannot perform an action. Your very model is logically
incoherent. Tony, you're bound by time. Your language and even your use of the word time is your limited thinking, because you're in time. God's outside of time.
That's an assumption.
So you don't have that understanding.
That's an assumption.
This one from Alejandro Vallejo says, James, you should ask the debaters to submit their supporting papers beforehand for the other side to review. It would show how much the creationists are misunderstanding and misrepresenting the data.
So,
yes.
How do you like?
So, I agree.
Can I respond?
Oh, you
to
agree.
That?
Okay. No, I want to respond. Okay. Matt and I, we've done presentation after presentation going over all of these technical papers in detail. We just did a 4.5-hour debate seminar with Conspiracy Cast, where we went over many of these papers. We've written books. If these guys don't want to do their homework to actually prepare and come equipped to a debate on biological evolution, that's a them problem, not a Matt and I problem. The material is out there for them to look at and examine, which they clearly didn't do, which is why they did not meet their burden tonight.
There are thousands of papers. Nobody in any lifetime could possibly go over all of them. The spirit That's of the true. Question is, well, I want to know what papers you're going to specifically refer to so that we could perhaps know if you're misrepresenting them, like Matt did, because I asked, I fed that Parsons paper into this because Matt said, oh yeah, that paper shows, this is like the very first super chat we got, demonstrates the fixation in the population. No, it doesn't do that. The paper from 1997 tracked mitochondrial DNA mutations in human maternal lineages, specifically in hypervariable regions, HVR-1 of the control region, which is non-coding. They sequenced mitochondrial DNA from all these individuals, 134 maternally related, found 10 mutations across those transmissions, and used that to find in mutation over 33 generations for whatever, whatever. So they were looking at mutation appearance in small family lineages, not population level fixation.
Matt, feel free to respond. I think Matt has the right to respond to that attack. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, they actually have a chart on their on the thing. You can find it on ResearchGate because it's free. The other ones are behind a paywall, but ResearchGate shows you the study in 1997 Parsons, and you can scroll down, and below the mutation rate is the substitution rate. So you'll see like 0.05 and then a number, right? And then below that, you'll see the 1-17. I can pull it up on the screen if I can find it in time.
No, the Parsons paper did not demonstrate how long it takes for a gene or a mitochondrial mutation to reach fixation in a population. Mutation rate, how long it takes a mutation to arise in a germ cell. Fixation rate, how long it takes for the mutation to spread and become universal in the population. It's not a paper that goes over fixation. It's a paper that goes over different things, but that's how you feel about it, whatever.
Interesting, because there is the picture itself directly from the paper.
Where's the fixation?
You can see the mutation rate right here above and the substitution rate below.
Where's the fixation?
Mutation rate. The substitution rate is the right here. 1 out of 17.
Chat,
one out
what
of
is
32,
it doing?
One out of
Where's
18?
The fixation?
The fixation rate is below the mutation rate.
You just said that's substitution, not fixation.
Yes, the
substitution.
The substitution rate equals the fixation rate. So when a mutation accumulates and reaches fixation, it takes that 17 generations to get there. So when a substitution arises, you're looking at a substitution rate, which is the fixation rate. So a substitution arises one every 17 generation, and the fixation rate equals the mutation rate, which is how they got the 6,500 years.
So you said it takes 17 generations. And then Donnie said, is that specific enough for you? But you just said it's not fixation, it's substitution.
Yes, that is the... So,
there you go.
But Eric, you must have misheard.
No, I didn't.
Or you didn't hear what I said earlier about basic population genetics, that the neutral mutation rate approximates the fixation rate. So if your neutral mutation rate is 0.1 or let's say one per generation, then by definition, the fixation rate, the long-term substitution rate is what, Eric? Let's see if you're paying attention. If the per generation
not,
rate's
not
one,
to you.
Well, and that's why the audience can see that you got absolutely dismantled in this debate. So let me ask again, very basic.
Okay, so anybody else can feed that paper into an LLM or something, and it'll spit out the same answer. No, this paper does not establish what they are claiming.
We must go to the next one. Smokey the Fallen Saint says, standing for truth, you ignore a decrease in genetic diversity through death and genocide and isolation would increase mutation rates and ruin your young Earth creationist timeline of genetic entropy.
Well, that's a very uninformed assertion. The fact that we get subpopulations that, let's say, become isolated, inbred, and accelerate genetic degeneration, that's local genetic degeneration, genetic entropy, which applies to the population level genetic degeneration. For example, the mutation rate is roughly 100 new mutations per person per generation. There are 7 to 8 billion people on the planet. That's 800 billion new mutations entering the population today. So genetic entropy is the fact that every generation is a little bit more mutant than the previous generation, and selection is so limited, it can't see the majority of those mutations. So what do? They build up and they degenerate. They're taking things the wrong way for fish to fisherman evolution to be true.
Is genetic entropy an accepted technical term in the evolutionary literature?
No.
Genetic degeneration is. Genetic entropy is was coined by Dr. John Sanford. Very well respected.
It's a creationist term.
But he's published in the peer-reviewed literature.
Yes. Has he published his findings on genetic entropy in the peer-reviewed literature?
No.
Yes, he's got many papers in the peer-reviewed literature. Tony,
that's answering a different question.
What a politician answer.
Yes, he has. Name one
where?
Paper.
Please provide the citation.
I want to see if you're informed, Tony. Name a single paper written by Dr. John Sanford in the conventional literature.
I can't. There you go.
You're uninformed, ill-equipped for this debate.
We must move to the next
debaters
one.
Than you guys.
We have to go to the next one. I hate to do this, guys, but we just have so many. Taking Back Eden, Flat Earth says, PhD Tony /PP, why are you correct about the age of the Earth versus Christian scientists that have looked at the same evidence and have come to different conclusions? Are you being partial or biased?
We let the evidence speak for itself. So, like, for example, with the age of the Earth, we can see billions of light years. How is that even remotely acceptable if the entire universe is 7,000 years old, like creation says? And creationists know that they can't do anything with this. There's a really interesting, I talk about it in my book, there's a really interesting article on Answers in Genesis where they get a real astronomer to go over all the arguments for how the universe could possibly be billions of light years across, but only 7,000 light years, but only 7,000 years old. And he basically debunks all of them. At the end, he fully admits the only possible explanation, or the only explanation he sees, is miraculously bringing the light to us. So then you would ask the question. This is why it's completely anti-scientific and it's all post hoc. Okay, so billions of light years is consistent with 7,000 year creation. Okay, so then if we could only see for 7,000 light years, then the Bible would be false. Obviously, they don't think that's the case because it's all post hoc. God is a magical sky wizard and he can do anything. So no matter what the observations were, because God's magic and all powerful, he could make it look that way.
James, can I respond real quick?
I would like to respond to this at some point as well.
So I can give you a really pithy response, Donnie, okay, and then PhD Tony, but then we got to go to the next one.
That's fair. It's also outside of the topic, but I've got a mini presentation here. Dr. Jason Lyle, PhD astrophysicist, has actually answered the distant starlight problem. And, you know, for sake of time, I won't be able to go through all of these, but it's consistent with the physics of Einstein that what we're looking at is light, even from the most distant galaxies, in real time, completely scientific, not a challenge at all.
Yes, Lyle's commentary is completely inconsistent with Maxwell's equations, which give no hint of any possible anisotropy in the speed of light, which is what Lyell's hypothesis relies on. But to answer Eden's claim, the why do we accept that we're getting accurate answers? Well, we use different techniques to the same samples and we get consistent results. We use different radiometric techniques on the same samples and we get consistent results between those. We then compare them with cosmogenic isotope results, which are from a different, completely different physical principle, and we get the same results. And then we can compare them with amino acid racemization, which is a completely different physical principle, and we get consistent results. And finally, when we apply the dates that we have derived in the setting of mineral exploration, we provide extremely accurate data on when and where mineral-bearing deposits will be located. So mineral companies invest a lot of money in paying for geochronological analysis because geochronological analysis gives reliable, robust, repeatable, and accurate, demonstrably accurate results. Young Earth creationism completely fails to do any of this. We have
Tony,
two
you're preaching. You're
hypotheses.
preaching.
We have
I
two
do have two.
Hold on, Tony.
Which is
Hey,
accurate
James,
and one
I just
which
have a
isn't.
3 second
And you're
question.
not, and
I'm not
actually,
even going
Tony,
to
you're
respond.
not the
Just a few
moderator.
seconds.
And I'm
Tony, you're
not, no,
preaching.
I'm not going
It's
to.
not fair that we
It
don't
was
get
a
an
question
opportunity.
to.
I hate to interrupt. I do want to do this. So, Donnie, I can't give you a rebuttal. I'm sorry. We just
What about just a question?
give PhD Tony the last word. And I do want to give him a chance to actually wrap up a sentence because even though I will say we do have to make it pithy, I want to give you a chance to wrap up PhD Tony, and then we have to go to the next question. Oh, you're still muted, PhD Tony. Let me unmute you. Sorry about that. No, Tony, you're still muted. Sorry about that.
Okay,
There you go.
sorry. Essentially, standard geochronological techniques work in practice. Young Earth creationism completely fails to provide any practically useful results.
This one from Dr. Dino says, I'll be hosting an after show for this debate. Creationists, evolutionists, soy boys, everyone is welcome. Just be polite. We'll send Eric the link. This one from Child Yuvalwei says, pro-evolutionists have complained whether the opponent's sources are or aren't from creationists. Well, what should they bring as evidence then?
If the science genuinely supports their position, as they have claimed at repeated points through this, they should be content just to present the scientific evidence without cherry picking and without misleading abbreviations or misleading quotations. They should just be content to rely on the peer-reviewed literature if the peer-reviewed literature supports their position. It doesn't. They know there doesn't. They know it doesn't, and that's why they've adopted the tactics that they have.
No, we don't know it doesn't. We actually supported all of our claims and arguments during the debate. So don't tell me, Tony, what I know.
This is coming in from
Go ahead.
Witsit Gets It says, Tony. Seeing as how you and Eric dodged the genetic evidence presented entirely, would you concede that your side utterly failed to defend biological evolution in this debate?
I thought we had this question already.
Oh, did
I
you?
don't accept
Sorry.
the I don't accept the first statement and I don't accept the second statement, but with you're getting money from Witsit, that's a better source for the money.
This is actually so okay, you're right, Eric, that there was one that was like very much like this
Okay.
before from Witsit, but yeah, they're like slightly different.
It's such an important point that it deserves to be brought up a couple
This one
times.
is,
Yeah.
oh
Yes,
boy, you.
it's very often the case, Donnie, that the participants in a competition get to declare themselves the winner. That's exactly how most contests work. The
Well,
fact that
Tony.
you've been wandering around here like a six-year-old going, "We won, we won, we won," really does a lot of credit to you.
Just go click the rewind button and see who dodged. Dodge, duck, dip, dive, and dodge. That's all you did, Tony.
This
Five
is
D's a
from
dodgeball. You didn't
Kevin Blackwell says, thank you, Matt. That means it would take 34 billion years to get the 1.4% difference between chimps to humans. 13 million years isn't anywhere close. I think this was actually for Eric and Tony.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I'd have to see like his work on that. Like he's just saying, oh, it would take billions of years. I mean,
yeah, the calculation here is incorrect. I've seen this addressed before. I'm not in a position to repeat the argument here, but no, that's not a correct interpretation of the data.
You got it. This one from Shuween says, I'm eating fresh. James, good for you. Alejandro Vallejo says, Donnie, actual, formal, truth-seeking, good faith, scientific debates submit their supporting papers beforehand all the time. If you are scared of truth, just say so, but change your channel name then.
You know what's cool is we have we have tons of papers.
I'll change it to sitting for truth because I am sitting about 99% of the time. So, Matt, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, yeah, we have so many papers on your channel now that like people can pretty much find any of the topics we're going to bring up.
Yeah, it just shows they're not doing the homework. So I'm not going to do my opponent's homework for them.
Taking back Eden.
Yes, so and this gets
Tony,
back to
Tony. The, you don't this need gets the back to the donors.
Why is Donnie moderating?
This gets back to the donors. To the donor's point, which is that you are not interested in presenting your arguments so that they can be tested robustly. You are only interested in winning a casual debate. So the allegation that they leveled against you, you just conceded. Thank you.
Tony, Eric, did we bring up any new papers, any new references that we haven't brought up 50, 100
How would
times
I know?
Before?
I
exactly.
Watch,
you didn't
I don't
do
watch
your homework.
Your debates.
Exactly. Yeah, so many click.
I've studied evolution for years. I did do my homework. Yeah, I've literally
like
written a book about it.
Yes, you're related to banana plants and strawberries, Eric.
Yes, we share genes with
believe,
bananas. Even you know
this. Well, you know what?
That's what it means to be related to something
too.
Is to share genes with it.
Evolved from a common Arctic ancestor millions of years ago. Okay. Homology it's agnostic largely. And you guys didn't even answer the question. Why do we have such strong signatures in terms of homology in the first place? If common descent is true, just a lot of dodging though, but that's not
this
an
one.
Answer.
I have to move to the next one. Beasticle says, why does Tony claim he's not an expert in genetics yet makes an argument using genetics? P.S. I'm driving, so be careful responding to me, Tony.
Okay, I encourage people who are driving not to use social media and not to type super chats. It's dangerous. This is a snide reference to the fact that I won't engage in technical discussions or arguments with people who are driving because it runs the risk that they'll have a crash, and even if the risk is small, it's something that I prefer to avoid. I don't need to be an expert to cite literature. That's the purpose of literature, is that it has been peer-reviewed by experts, interpreted by experts, and validated and replicated by experts. That is the value of peer-reviewed literature. I don't need to be an expert myself to read and present scientific literature. So the entire point is fatuous.
You got it. This one coming in from Kevin Blackwell, or I'm sorry, Taking Back Eden PE says, Planet Peterson, I challenge you to debate Whitsitt on heliocentrism. No pressure, much love.
On heliocentrism versus geocentrism? I mean, maybe. I don't know. Whitsitt's just so not worth anybody's time, but it could be fun.
He's your twin brother, Eric. Okay. Alejandro says Donnie, actual. Oh, we got this one. Oh, you're near the end of the questions. Folks, we're going to read through these last ones and want to encourage you to not send any more just so we can get our guests out of here at a decent time. This one coming in from, do appreciate it. Whitsitt. Yeah, we got that. And then T-Maz says, aside from being wrong on evolution, Donnie is rude, arrogant, and impatiently spoke over the opposition. He has read Colossians 3:12. Even other Christians should see him for the jerk he is.
Very, very sweet of them. You know what? This is what I like to say. If you can't handle the heat, stay out of the kitchen. But I think Tony and Eric, you know what? They did fine. They're a little passive. So they should be able to enjoy some aggressive banter, I think.
This one from you guys are like brothers, you know, just like it's like in a rough house and they
Yeah.
fight. This one from Eric's brother, Witsit Gets It, says, can all debaters disavow a partner reading off chat GPT or
Ooh.
direct messages that they don't even understand, trying to pass it off as a refutation?
No.
Yeah,
Yes.
Tony's the only scientist here. I'm not going to sit here and like make the argument that, well, Donnie has never actually published any genetics work or whatever. At some level, Donnie doesn't understand what he's reading in the studies he brought up. At some level, Matt doesn't understand the studies that he brought up. At some level, I don't understand any study or anything that I brought up. It's just completely bunk to make this argument. But also to that, again, the three of us, none of us have ever done any actual scientific research. I did a little bit in college, actually. But so we have to get it from somebody. And so we get it from reading books and we get it from going to online studies. If I get it from somebody I know bringing up a fact to me, that's no different than me reading a book the day before the debate. It's just that because it's happening in real time, somehow that's bad or whatever. And what's hilarious is Witsit, this is literally a genetic fallacy, which you cried about earlier with one of your super chats. So you guys go.
Well, it's funny. It's funny because Eric seems to know us more than we know ourselves. Because yes, we've done many. We're currently engaged in research projects. We've published many books, many articles. We've studied this in detail. But Eric, you're missing the point. You could not counter the evidence that we were presenting on the topic of molecular clocks and mitochondrial Eve and the papers we were citing, like Parsons. And so it's not like you just had somebody explain to you what the research meant. No, you sought an outside source for a rebuttal, but even that rebuttal failed. So I mean, it's just an epic failure all
Literally
around,
didn't, but
Eric.
whatever.
And well, it did actually, yeah.
It actually literally didn't.
What's coalescence,
So
Eric? A word.
the point that I would make is that actually the truth is more important than who won the debate.
Yes, and banana
So
plants are not
I
related to
and
heat,
I was
Tony.
still speaking there, Donnie. Another example of your Christian charity in talking over me because you're that considerate. How about you behave like a grown-up and wait until I'm finished speaking and then we can move on? But I'll resume my statement. The truth matters more than point scoring or more than debate theatrics. And this is what frustrates me about this format. Is Donnie crowing around like clowning around like he didn't he and his colleague didn't misrepresent a bunch of scientific literature, wouldn't have been violently disagreed with by the authors of that literature. And then
Yeah, but
and
you didn't
so
show why.
I actually esteem accuracy,
Tony, you're
and I
preaching. You
don't
just
care
went
and I
over it. We're
don't
3 hours
care
in.
how I get it.
We must go to the next one. Do appreciate it. Actually, I think that might be it. Let me just double check. I know I had one from the standard chats that Marilyn, thanks for your kind super chat. You're such a flirt. Okay. This one was from I know I copied and pasted it. Let me find this. Sebastian Jacobson says, what are your thoughts on self-propagating aspects of human evolution? TLDR, which for those of you boomers means too long didn't read, says human beings influence their own evolutionary process at a disproportionately rapid rate in present times. Who's that
Sure,
for?
we have remarkable technology that intervenes on our on the way we survive, things that were death sentences not very long ago no longer are. And so, yeah, that probably has profound effects on population genetics and whatever else. It's, I don't think that proves anything one way or the other.
I think what's really cool about that is that if you look in human history, everything goes back just about 5,000 years, from writing, math, architecture, megalithic structures. Like, you just go back to the same time period, everything's just right there.
The genetic data that Tony's so scared of.
The genetic data.
Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 years old.
But fossils, my fossils.
Mitochondrial Eve.
Yeah, mitochondrial Eve.
Mitochondrial Eve, the stone tool.
Why chromosomes worldwide in all males. Why chromosomes have very low genetic variation.
First human habitation of North America. All of that goes back way further than 6,000 years.
And a Y chromosome will last universal.
And I'll continue going on.
Yeah, see, Tony, you can't handle the truth. That's why you have to interrupt, and that's okay.
No, you were interrupting me.
Epic failure here tonight, okay, Tony?
Okay, great.
Okay, I think that's it. That was the last question. James, are you there, brother?
Yes, I am.
Oh.
What we're going to do is, folks, I want to let you know a couple of things. First, all of our guests are linked in the description box. If you haven't yet, even if you disagree with them, there is value to checking out their links, because even if you disagree with them, it's great to get to hear straight from the horse's mouth what they're actually saying rather than what someone says that they're saying. The other thing is, I do want to remind you folks, DebateCon 6 coming up next month. Grab your tickets. They're linked in the description box. That's in Nashville. You don't want to miss it. And if you have Amazon Prime, that means you have a free Twitch sub that you can use to help support Modern Day Debate. I am putting that Twitch link. So if you guys don't know, Twitch is like a YouTube type of website. If you're really new to this, I want to encourage you to use your free sub for Modern Day Debate. We really do appreciate that help. Seriously, it means a lot. And with that, I'm going to be back in just a moment. I'll let you know about upcoming debates, folks. Stick around. But first, I want to say huge thank you to our guests of the lifeblood of the channel. They make this possible. Thank you very much, Matt, Tony, Eric, and Donnie, for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Had a lot of fun, James. Thanks for the invite, brother.
Thanks, James.
Thank you. And thank you, Eric, for partnering me. I would have been a bit of a burden in this debate, I feel.
My only goal for this debate was to get PhD Tony to smile once, and I failed. So I'm sorry, guys. Maybe next time, Tony. Come on, you can do it.
Tony's face.
Come on, you got it.
Well, we want to say he wants to smile a little bit. I could
tell. Let's see. Come on, a little smirk. I'm going to put him full screen.